Hey folks, Shag here. Just a few thoughts before we roll into this month's episode. First off, prepare yourself for a long one. We're covering two annuals this episode that are more than double-sized, so it's kind of like covering five comics in one episode. We move through it pretty quick, but it still takes some time. Second, as promised last episode during the feedback section, I want to give a shout-out to my One Punch Warriors. I challenged folks last episode to leave a specific comment in the feedback, and these folks really came through. Honestly, I expected like a few people to participate, but we got nearly 50 people responding. That's incredible. So let me tell you, these folks are the best. They listen to the comic coverage, they listen to the feedback section, and they can follow directions. I'm pretty impressed. So a very sincere thank you to these One Punch Warriors, including Adam Ackerman, Al Girding, Alan Mozick, Brad Dade, Brad Glynn, Brian Schufo, Bucky749, Captain Entropy, Chris Lewis, Clinton Robinson, Damian Lee, David J. Cook, DC Dave, Doug Adamson, Gene Hendricks, Herbert Fung, Jason Keen, Jason R. Lady, Jossum One, John Coos, Jose Sarti or Mazinger 1978, Keechee Baker, Leslie Trigg, Lizanne Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matthew Cody, Mike Dynas, Noah Tarnow, Norman Wins, Nuno Duarte, Paul Hicks, Paul Wildenberger, Rob McCarthy, Robert J. Smith, Sean Emmons, Sean Ross, Stephen Cronin, Sub Gum Doug, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, Tim Price, the only American Captain Britain fan, Vernon A. Schweitzer Jr., and Ward Hill Terry. Thanks again to these amazing folks. For the rest of you, please consider sticking around for the feedback section for each episode. Lots of fun commentary in there. And now, let's kick off our coverage of
Armageddon 2001.
Meanwhile, in Justice League America, annual number 5, and Justice League Europe, annual number 2, cover dated 1991. Hello, and welcome to the Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. This episode is another of our Meanwhile episodes, and what that means is that we take a break from the usual numbered issues to provide a chance to look at the JLI outside of the ongoing monthly series, and in this case, we're diving into
Armageddon 2001.
The crossovers covering both the 5th JLA annual and the 2nd JLE annual. Now, by the way, my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I am not flying solo, thankfully, because every episode I'm joined by a couple of friends to help me cover the issues. So we're going to chat with my second co-host in a minute, but for now, my first co-host today is a seasoned podcaster, having covered everything from Spider-Man to the early days of Marvel to the New 52 Superman to Superman during Crisis on Infinite Earths and a whole bunch more. And I mean, this guy, he really, really likes Superman. In fact, he recently moved across the country for supposedly valid reasons, but I'm thinking he did it just to be a little bit closer to Metropolis, Illinois. That's just my take on it. Now, also, check this out. This guy's a nut. He has read every single comic starring Superman since 1938, and every Justice League comic. Now, they didn't go back to 1938, obviously. Anyway, from 1938 to 1993, he has read every single comic with Superman as the feature character in Justice League. Get a hobby, man. Jeez. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. John Wilson. Welcome to the New York Embassy, John. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I don't know how to monetize this achievement, but I'm trying to figure it out. So like somewhere out there, if you can just help me find a job for someone who has read 50 plus years of Superman comics, I'm there. I've got the resume. I can do it.
Congratulations. You're hired as the biggest loser ever.
I wish I could lose. That's the next goal.
You know more about Steve Lombard than anyone else alive. Congratulations.
Oh, that ass. Yeah, I do. I do. Man, I don't hate him as much as Flash Thompson, but man, I hate him a lot.
So what led you down that path to read every single Superman and Justice League comic?
Okay, so it's kind of just sort of my move when I get into a franchise to start at the beginning. I just am usually not as stick-to-itive as I have been with Superman. Mm-hmm. So back in 2009, a friend of mine, a call center I was working at, he was really enjoying Green Lantern's Geoff Johns emotional spectrum stuff. And he's like, mm-hmm. you really need... And I had just been getting back into comics from 2008 with the Iron Man movie. I'd gotten back into superhero comics for the first time as an adult. And he's like, you really need to check out Green Lantern. So of course, when he says you check out Green Lantern, I go and get All American Comics 16 and start reading all the Alan Scott stuff. And then I'm like, okay, so I want to read one of the big two, either Superman or Batman. And I read a lot of Batman as a kid because my brother collected Batman. And I had read a couple of Superman stories, including the Armageddon 2001 annuals. So the Armageddon 2001 crossover was my first DC comic book stories.
Really?
First ones. And I had read The Death of Superman because everyone did. They handed it to you whenever you were like 12 in 1992. So
came in a care package.
Right? So I thought, you know, I wanted to read more about Superman. So I just started in two places. I did some research. I started in Action Comics 1 and I started The Man of Steel number 1 and just started reading, you know, from both starting points. And about 5 minutes after I started that, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor started there From Crisis to Crisis podcast. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what kind of weird Ewok magic was synergizing us together like that, but
yub.
Yeah, exactly. So I had their podcast to go along with as I was reading through, you know, relatively modern stuff. I was reading through the Golden Age, and my Golden Age reading just never stopped. And I kept reading. I read all of the Action Comics, the Supermans, the World's Best and World's Finest comics, and New York World's Fair comics. You have Superboy, Adventure Comics. You have More Fun Comics, Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, Justice League of America. And I just kept on going. I did read all of the Justice Society adventures along the way too, because I kept reading Green Lantern. I read all of the Golden Age Green Lantern stories and Justice Society stories too.
Nice.
And I just never stopped. And I was actually able to get to the Death of Superman story just after its 30th anniversary. I tried to make it by the 30th anniversary. Life stuff happened in the way. But I am currently reading Superman comics from 30 years ago. And right now, just kind of keeping that pace. But I have read every Superman comic that is older than 30 years as of this point.
That's amazing. Now, not to tell you how you could have done things different, but I'm just going to say, you know, if having read Armageddon 2001 as being your launching point, if you had just chosen someone like Booster Gold instead, you could have had it done in like 2 weeks. I'm just saying.
I read the 80s Booster Gold series and the 80s Blue Beetle series along the way, because evidently someone was doing a podcast and said that they were really good books. So I did.
So John and I, he requested to be on this episode 7 years ago. That's not an exaggeration. We looked it up. We found literally the date and the time that he reached out to me and said, hey, Shag, I got a question. And it's a couple months shy of 7 years when he reached out. And it was funny because I watched you reading these Superman comics and reading the Justice League comics. And at one point, I remember you like tweeting or something like, I got to speed up or I'm not going to make it in time to be on Shag's show. Because you wanted to have read everything, up to this point when you appeared on the show.
Yeah, that was the goal. And, you know, I wasn't exactly sure how much of a lead time you had. And because of other Meanwhile episodes you've done, it's taken you a little bit long here mm-hmm. to get here than I thought it would. But yeah, I wanted, whenever I got to this point, to have it as part of the Superman read-through. So, and of course, Superman's not in this era of the Justice League, but for me, Justice League is a Superman book, even sure. in the eras where he's not in it. So the same for Legion, and really less so, but still the Fourth World corner of DC. Oh. All of that stuff is Superman adjacent to me. Okay. So I've been reading all that stuff along the way. And, but yeah, reading JLI, JLE, and JLE along with the show has been an intrinsic part of my Superman read-through. And I wanted to make sure that I was here with it all under my belt whenever we did our show.
So I haven't told you this before now, and this is going to be your first time hearing this, and the same time everyone on the air hears it. So I owe you a debt of gratitude because you gave me a compliment, which was foolish. You should never, ever give me a compliment. But anyway, you gave me a compliment.
I really didn't mean to. What did I say?
Which then energized me. You pointed out that during the pandemic, I had stopped missing months. Because prior to the pandemic, I had missed the occasional month or here or there. Like, I fell behind. I'm like, oh, I can't get an episode out this month or whatever. Because life got in the way. But at some point, I managed to go month without missing a month. And you putting something on Twitter about it. It was a nice compliment. You're like, hey, Shag, you managed to get an episode out every month for a year now or something like that. And that became a mantra in the back of my head. I'm like, I am not missing a month again. Whatever it takes, I'm getting an episode out every month now. And you helped push me along. And I owe that debt of gratitude. And I guess the listeners, if they're enjoying the show, owe that debt of gratitude to you as well.
Well, that is neat. I appreciate that. Yeah, I just, I know what it is to miss months. My Amazing Spider-Man Classics show had a very irregular schedule, even though it was theoretically more than monthly. And so, yeah, I know that feeling of, man, I wish I'd gotten that out there, but man, I just didn't get around to it. So whenever I saw that you had actually stuck with a regular release schedule, I was like, hey, that guy's doing it. So I just wanted to give you a little attaboy. So yay.
And I appreciate it. And it came at a very difficult time too, when this stupid podcast series went to 2 issues a month. So, well, we could talk all day, and we're gonna, because we have a lot to talk about with this annual, folks. Before we get too much further into that, though, we should take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Each episode, we're going to pick a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and it's tied into the book in some way, shape, or fashion. Mine is very tangentially related, but I don't care because I love this series so much. I picked Suicide Squad Casualties of War trade paperback. Now, normally, when you're thinking Suicide Squad, you're thinking either the modern stuff, like maybe some Tom Taylor stuff, or you're thinking the John Ostrander stuff. Oh, no. This was a brief window in 2001, a 12-issue series of Squadron Supreme. I'm sorry, Suicide Squad. The written by Keith Giffen. Yeah, Keith Giffen of Bwahaha wrote 12 issues of Suicide Squad, and they are glorious. It's literally, it feels like a mashup between Ostrander Suicide Squad and the Bwahaha Justice League. There's humor, but there's tragedy. There's all kinds of nasty criminals fighting with each other. You know, Killer Frost is in it, if you're a Firestorm fan. Major Disaster's in it, if you're a JLI fan. Deadshot and Reactron and Blackstar and a bunch of people. Anyway, and the cool thing is Sergeant Rock is in it. I'm not going to say any more. If you've read it, you know what I'm saying. Anyway, it's out there. You can get it on Stock Trades right now. Again, it's all 12 issues. It is normally $29.99, but you can get it for 42% off, so it's only $17.39, and I absolutely stinking love this comic. So, sir, I have to ask you, all the other cool kids tend to bring something to the show. Did you happen to bring something to share with the class?
I was just out today, and I happened to see that Oreo cookies are buy two, get the third free at Publix, so y'all should definitely go down and do that.
Don't start the Publix talk. Oh my gosh. The comment threads are, they love to talk about Publix ice cream. Now they're going to talk about Publix Oreos. The BOGOs. All right. What'd you bring?
So this is apropos of nothing except for my Superman read through and the fact that a slightly later era of this comic series. In my Superman read through, I have gotten just to the end of Funeral for a Friend. So as I recorded this at the end of January of 2023, the end of January 1993 saw Superman 78, where he is flying into the sky on the cover. And it's an issue that ends with Jonathan Kent flatlining. Yep. And there are no Superman books for 3 months, except for the occasional one-shot special.
Yep.
That's where I am my read through. And the in 2016, DC put out a 5-volume collection of the Death and Return of Superman storyline. And the first volume of those, the Death of Superman story itself, is on In Stock Trades. This is the second Superman comic book story I ever read. Mm. I read the original printing back in Christmas of 1992. I actually can see myself in Nebraska at my stepmother's parents' house reading this in the bedroom where I would sleep and being completely mystified by why Supergirl turned into a purple blob whenever she got hit by Doomsday. But also has the JLI in it. So the Justice League America that's immediately after this incarnation appears in that story. So they're in the trade. And this is $17.99 normally, but with your in-stock trades discount of 42% off, it is available for $10.43. Yeah, go relive. It's the 30th anniversary. Have you read The Death of Superman lately? Go get a copy.
It's so good. I like Funeral for a Friend quite a bit. It's really powerful. It gets me every time. But Death of Superman is really powerful. I don't know if I've ever, I know I've talked about it on a few podcasts here and there, especially with Michael Bailey. I don't know if I've ever talked about Death of Superman here on this show. We don't have time today, but folks, if you don't know, I was working in a comic shop when Death of Superman came out. So I was there selling them. I was there with the black poly bags and the line of customers around the building, which was insane, and wearing the armband and all that. It's heady, crazy times.
I completely forgot to talk about this on my recent podcast where I talked about gifts that Mindy has gotten, because technically it wasn't a gift, but Mindy, my girlfriend, and I went to a comic book shop recently, and they had a bunch of 1991, 1992 comics, like Number One Image Comics, X-Force mm-hmm. One, and they had Superman 75.
In the black bag printings. Still?
There was a black bag one. The black bag was open, but okay. Then everything was like in a comic book bag together. Yeah. I didn't pay $25 for that. Mm-hmm. I just paid a handful of dollars for just a standard printing of Superman 75. So now I have my very own copy of the original Death of Superman issue.
Nice. That's awesome.
My girlfriend is, she supports and feeds my hobby. I'm not entirely sure how she realizes that, how unhealthy that is.
The word you're looking for is enabler, and bless her for that.
Enabler, just an enabler.
Congratulations on finding your enabler.
Right.
So, folks, for all of these and your trade paperback needs, although you can't find your enabler there, you can find all your trades you want, though, over at instocktrades.com. Now, folks, this episode is also sponsored in part with your support through our Patreon. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows and all the hosting and services and things like that, you know, takes a fair amount of money. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI Podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI Podcast. Our thanks go out to Chris Lewis, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Michael Zonkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. All right, folks, it is time to get out on the social media. This is a big deal. Armageddon 2001, you all remember it. You all remember the hype. You remember Captain Adam's importance in this thing, right? Get on the social media. Tag us at JLI Podcast. John, what's your Twitter handle?
I am at John Reads Comics, which goes along with johnreadscomics.com, where my podcasts live.
Nice plug. So tag us both there. Let us know your thoughts on Armageddon 2001. Let us know your thoughts on this issue, because there's a lot to talk about and a lot of different artists and things like that. I want the conversation to keep going. Also, go out to our website, of course, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI. Share your thoughts there. Now, John, I need to ask you, man, we got a little insight as to Death of Superman and things like that, but what's your personal origin story with the JLI? How'd you find the team, and what was the trigger that made you fall in love?
So, my first exposure to the JLI would be whenever I was reading the Armageddon annuals back in 1991.
Wow.
I read this particular issue, I think, new. I think I was in the stores the week this came out, and I found the Superman issue and the like a fourth printing of the Armageddon 2001 number one issue, and got all of that, and then just kept on buying the annuals. But this was my first exposure to a comic book version of the Justice League after catching the random episode of Super Friends growing up. Mm. So I remember Fire and Ice and Martian Manhunter and Blue Beetle and Booster Gold and Guy Gardner. Those were my first exposure to DC Comics superheroes in comic book form. And they just kind of stuck with me. I never followed the book. Of course, I saw them again in The Death of Superman whenever that issue. I don't know. A few years ago, somebody started a podcast about this team. It wasn't yours. I think it was Justice Mates from Chris and Stacy Franklin.
They
were talking about this team. And yeah, so, you know, I was listening to them and trying to find other podcasts. I actually volunteered back in 2016 for a guest spot on it. It was supposed to happen in 2020. It never did. But I think that was from Justice to Justice, the podcast with Michael Bailey and Jeff Taylor. So, you know, I was doing my Superman read through from 2009, on, and I got to the debut of the JLI, JLA, all the acronyms. Mm-hmm. So I started listening as I was reading. I found that, I don't know, Was it Waiting for Bwahaha and their sister show, the JLOCD? I don't know what I was listening to, some other JLI podcast.
Yeah,
and
I think that was it.
And now you've started your own JLI podcast. So I never actually read this series until the last handful of years as part of my Superman read-through. And that's one of the reasons why I haven't wanted to be on an earlier episode, because I just didn't know I didn't know the context. I knew this issue, but I wanted to know the whole series before I got to something that I loved. So here we are. I want to congratulate you on starting this show up and being so great with it and having me on.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I really have been following everyone else's efforts with the JLI before this. So I'm just glad that you took an interest and wanted to be on here. So thank goodness all the other opportunities fell through for you. I'm glad you're here with me. You killed me with the JLI OCD. That's what broke me. All right, folks, we're going to get into this. Remember, go out to our website, firewaterpodcast.com/JLI podcast, and we will post a few images from these issues out there for you to look at. I got to tell you, this one's a little tricky. It's not in the Omnibuys. It is not available digitally on DC Infinite either. For some reason, neither of these issues we're going to cover today. So you're going to have to go out and find the floppies. I don't think they ever did an Armageddon 2001 omnibus or anything like that.
I looked for one. I did not see any hint of one.
Yeah. So you're going to have to dig these out and find them, because they're interesting. They are very interesting time capsules. So
some of these are really, really good too. Like the Superman ones are pretty great.
Oh my gosh, they are.
The Flash annual is really good. This issue, I love. This is one of my favorite comics in history.
There's a lot of fun stuff in here. But yeah. Man, you mentioned that Superman. I could talk about the Superman annuals forever, but all right, we're going to do this. All right. So Justice League America, annual number 5, published by DC Comics, cover dated 1991, on the shelves May 28th, 1991. Cover price is $2, so 8 shiny quarters. And the cover is by Steve Carr and Joe Rubenstein. You want to describe the cover for us?
So we're in the hospital where I keep wanting to call him Max Landis. He's not freaking Max Landis. He's Maxwell Lord. Max Lord is lying in bed with a breathing mask on, and all of the team is arrayed around him. In the foreground is the flaming figure of Wave Rider. We only see a hand and like some side hip, like, you know, some sort of suggestive nudity there with flames coming out of it. And all of the team is looking over their shoulders going, "Bwah?" And that's basically the cover. It's not the most flattering shot of the team, but it definitely has everyone there. And, you know, Fire is spotlighted along with, you know, her fire.
For reasons, yes. Personally, I love the layout of this cover with like, because you really can't tell who Wave Rider is. He could be the Human Torch. He could be anybody. He's just somebody who's crackling with energy. And the League's looking at him, you know, in the shock, and Max is there in the center. And I just think it's a really, really well laid out design. It is one of those covers that depicts a scene that doesn't actually happen in the comic, but that's okay. Right. The only thing I think... And I don't mean to sound critical, because I do like the cover, but I feel a little let down, because it looks very Chris Sprouse, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but like when you look at it, if you look at like Fire's face and Beetle's face, it's like you can immediately tell that's a Chris Sprouse early 1990s thing. Overall though, I like it. I think it's a well composed cover, and I think it tells the story. You're right, Fire does have a little bit of a Brokeback chest explosion going on there, but that's kind of what that character's all about. I don't know. Do you like the cover?
I do. And since I got this for an Armageddon cover, I was always drawn to the actual fire of Wave Rider's figure.
Mm-hmm.
So my eye always goes to the logos at the top and the shape of Wave Rider. And to me, the team in the background was always kind of in the background. Mm. But just looking at it now, you know, even members who weren't regular, who of course are going to show up in the story, like Mr. Miracle and Booster Gold, who had departed some time back, they're all depicted here, and it's great. So you get to see the entire team. And if you're following the monthly issues, because here's one thing, annuals don't always tie directly into continuity, or they tie into continuity in, you know, sort of left-fielded ways. Right. This issue fits right into its release schedule.
Yeah.
And if you're reading the monthly comics, Maxwell Lord is laying there dying, and you know what's going on, and you're ready for it.
Yeah, it literally comes right off the heels of last issue, issue 52. So that is one of the nice things about it. That is why I chose to cover it here. Another interesting thing about this cover, too, is this might be the only Well, okay. So Justice League number 3 had a variant cover where they did Superman comics. That's the only other variant cover I can think of. This one actually has a quote-unquote variant cover. It's not really a variant. It was a second printing. They actually did a second printing on Justice League Annual number 5 because I guess it sold out of the printers or there was enough orders to merit it. And Armageddon 2001 was just that popular at first. So yeah, there is another version of this cover that the background's all silver. And in the UPC box, it actually says Silver Series. So there you go. If you're a hardcore collector, you got to go out there and get that one now, folks.
I think 1991 is whenever the comics industry was just starting to experiment with having special colors for variant printings, because that didn't used to happen.
Yeah.
You might have a mark somewhere on the cover to indicate it as a later printing, but you might not.
Isn't this after Legends of the Dark Knight number 1, where they had 5 different color covers?
That was a 1991 book, I'm pretty sure. So be around this same time.
Yeah.
But X-Men comes out this year.
Oh, wow. You're right.
Valiant starts up. But I remember because I got the Armageddon 2001 number 1. It was the fourth printing because it had a Roman numeral 4 on it. And it was all silver background as well.
Fourth printing. That's crazy. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Wow. All right, well, let's get into this, folks. So plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script by J.M. DeMatteis. Now, check this out. There are a lot of artists on this, and normally that's a bad thing. Not in this case. It's actually very interesting. So the framing and bridging sequences are penciled by Steve Carr with inks by Jose Marzan Jr. But then you get all these cutaways to the alternate futures, right? And they're all inked by Bruce Patterson. But check this out. It is a veritable who's who of JLI artists doing this. So the Martian Manhunter sequence is penciled by Chris Sprouse. The Gaia Gardner and Fire sequences are penciled by Derek Robertson. Ooh. Blue Beetle sequence is penciled by Marshall Rogers. The Ice sequence is penciled by Kevin McGuire. Booster Gold sequence is penciled by Dan Juergens. Mr. Miracle is by Joe Phillips. General Glory is by Ty Templeton. And Maxwell Lord is by Linda Medley. A whole bunch of old friends who have come back to the JLI book for this annual, which is great. The lettering is by Bob LePan. Colors is Gene D'Angelo. It says Future Shock, Kevin Dooley. And Anachronism, Andy Helfer. So the issue itself is called Tomorrow's League Today. You want to start us off?
So we open with Wave Rider doing some sort of air ballet as he flies in to creep on the Justice League America. He flies into their mansion and disguises himself as Captain America. Sorry, ha ha ha. Disguises himself as Captain Atom, which later turns out to be ironic, but then turns out to not really be ironic after all. So he runs into Elrond and then Martian Manhunter, and his very strong crush on the tall green Martian is immediately noticeable. They shake hands, and whenever he makes contact with the Martian Manhunter, we flash forward to 10 years later. We are in the Tibetan mountains as a man is climbing the mountains. His beard is scraggly. He's trying to find, you know, the secret to his life. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Strange has entered the chat. He's climbing up and he gets to the top to discover the green guru. And it's, of course, John Jones floating in the air in his Martian form. And Stephen Strange is like, you know, I've been looking for you all over. You know, can you please tell me what is the meaning of life? And in his infinite wisdom, the green guru utters, "Life, my son, is like an Oreo cookie." Man freaks out, runs out the door, griping and saying all sorts of things that aren't fit to print. So we go back to the present. Captain Atom / Wave Rider is a little bit confused by the whole Oreo cookie thing, but you know, whatever. He greets the League. They're all there in the hospital waiting room because Maxwell Lord is in the hospital. Captain Atom is nice to Guy, who comes up and touches his shoulder, and boom, contact. So we flash forward 10 years to the future, and we see a meeting of the cult of Guy Gardner. So if you want to be in the cult of Guy Gardner, you need two things. You need like 5 heaping spoonfuls of narcissism and a bowl haircut. Those two things will get you in the door. So they're getting ready for Guy's speech, and Guy's there. And of course, he's his usual, you know, jerky Guy self. But just as he's about to go on stage, somebody with a knife cuts the rope holding a sandbag, and it falls and bonks Guy Gardner on the back of the head. Now, you know, and I know what's going to happen next. So he wakes up. He's feeling kind of woozy. He's like, okay, on with the show. And he goes out to make his speech. But this is now Nice Guy. And we have a headline of Nice Guy finishes last as the crowd riots as the cult idol changes his tune. So we then go back to the present. Captain Adam slash Wave Rider is trying to figure out what's going on. He sees some redheaded dude sitting on the couch. He's like, this could be a superhero, but he doesn't have his mask on. Who could he be? And somebody calls him Beetle. He's like, oh, he's the Blue Beetle. So he touches the Blue Beetle on his shoulder. And we flash forward to the future where this redheaded, slightly overweight guy has become a balding, redheaded, very overweight guy. He has definitely let himself, you know, just kind of, I feel weird about this sequence because I feel like there's a lot of fat shaming going on. He has just not taken the efforts to maintain a superhero physique because guess what, folks? He's not a superhero anymore. So why should he? But he's also very, very depressed. And he's watching his own old ads that he did. He's bemoaning the fact that he sold the rights to the Blue Beetle identity. He goes to the costume and pulls out his stupendous silverfish costume, which got not so much striking fear and terror into the hearts of criminals, but striking laughter into their bellies instead. In the midst of his memories, he decides to go back and watch some more TV. And by the way, the pizza nearby delivers. So back to the present day. Ice is very sad about Max and about losing him. Like she's actually feeling this pretty deeply. And so Captain Adam slash Wave Rider goes over and rather familiarly puts his hand on her knee to comfort her. And of course, that gives us contact to flash forward to the future. Normally touching a woman's knee that you just met and getting amazed at the contact is not an attitude that we generally approve of. But however, Wave Rider is doing his thing. So in the future, Tora is living just a normal suburban single life with her cats. She's feeding them, she's living her life, and she hears on the news about Guy Gardner's cult turning against him and things being really bad for him. So she gets all freaked out because she hears he was struck on the head. He needs me after all these years. So she runs out to the beach, and sure enough, there is Guy sitting on a rock. She finds him very sad. They talk. They end up declaring their love for each other, and we go back to the present day. Tora actually has some residual sensations from this telechronal contact. They don't really go into it, but they just mention it in passing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Fire shows up. You know, she's Fire, and she's talking about how, you know, she cares, and her persona is just, you know, she's a survivor, but that doesn't mean that this is easy. And she puts her hand on Captain Adam slash Wave Rider's chest, and that is, of course, contact with Fire. And we go to the future as Fire and Oberon are sitting in the church where Tora slash Ice and Guy Gardner slash kind of sort of Green Lantern are getting married. And it's great. We mainly focus on Fire and Oberon being super cute. And Oberon is like, well, I guess, I don't know. Beat around the bush. Should I do this? Should I not? Reach under my head, tie and choke my collar, and pulls out a box. Will you marry me, B? And she's shocked and gives a big old hug. Can I take that as a yes? But who interrupts this moment of tender intimacy between this 10-year-old couple at this point? Ted Kord bursts through the door shouting, Fire! And normally when you run into a church shouting fire, everyone freaks out. But no, they totally sit and stay calm. Nothing else happens. He walks up to Beatrice and yells at her because after 10 years, he has discovered that the fashion company he sold the rights to Blue Beetle, who eventually forbade him to use the identity anymore, was Beatriz da Costa's own fashion company. His lawyer somehow has just now discovered this. And so he feels betrayed by an old friend. He's yelling at her. She's standing up saying, look, you had the contract. You could have read it. The fact that you wanted the money so you and Booster Gold could go off and do one of your get rich quick schemes, that's not my problem. You knew what you were getting into. You're an adult. And we don't see exactly what happens between them, except that Blue Beetle is arrested after an attempt on Model's life. So, yeah, things are going great for Ted Kord.
I'll take it from here. Now, John's a lot more creative than me, so I had to blatantly crib my recap from a blog called the Armageddon 2001 Revisited blog.
I spent at least 5 minutes ad-libbing that recap. I mean, come on, you could have done something.
Well, no, I just blatantly stole from them. So now that I think of it, maybe I should talk to the guy who ran that website someday. I don't know. Maybe more on that later. But all right, so it's my turn. So next up is Booster Gold's turn, actually. And Wave Rider sees the future. And there, and Booster is at the Space Museum in the 25th century. Michael Carter is a janitor in the superhero wing. He went back to the future and ended up getting arrested. And now he's a janitor. So Booster gets upset when he reads the biography of Ted Kord and how things turned out for him. So Booster decides to once again steal a time machine and return to the 20th century. All right. So then Wave Rider moves on to Mr. Miracle. It's time for his future. Now we see we're backstage at a sports arena and we see a group of people dressed similarly to Mr. Miracle. They're called the Miracle Squad. Scott Free gives the group a pep talk before their next performance of Amazing Escapes. Meanwhile, Oberon shows up and explains to Scott, he says, what's happened to Ted? Ted's been thrown in jail. Mr. Miracle repeatedly offers to break Ted out of prison, but Barda insists that she will discuss things with Fire and get her to calm down. Then Wave Rider moves on to General Glory. There we see Maxwell Lord visiting a very, very old man in a hospital room. Max addresses this person as General Glory, but the old man says that Glory has retired a long time ago. Max insists that America needs a symbol like Glory to help inspire the people and uses every line of patriotic pandering that he can imagine. Joe is convinced and once again utters his oath, becoming General Glory. Max and General relaunch the JLI with a roster of Aquaman, Ice, Guy Gardner, Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, and from the conglomerate, Vapor and Echo. However, they all sport bowl-style haircuts in honor of Glory's old sidekick, Ernie. Now, back in the present, Wave Rider, who, of course, is still disguised as Captain Atom, he leaves the embassy and goes to visit Maxwell Lord in the hospital. There, Wave Rider sees Max's future, and he is retired to the island of Kahui. Unexpectedly, a giant metal cube crashes onto the beach. It's Booster Gold, who's returned from the future. Booster convinces Max that it's time to get the JLI reformed. They return to the U.S. and meet with Fire. She insists she will not drop the lawsuit against Ted. And then off-panel, Max must have used his mind powers to convince Fire to persuade her to signing over controlling interest in her entire company over to Max. And in the final panel, we see Ice and Guy sitting at a breakfast table discussing the events with a drawing of what appears to be Guy's head with the word daddy written underneath, hanging on the refrigerator. To back in the present, Wave Rider attempts to see Max's future has unfortunately worsened modern-day Max's condition. The Daily Planet headline reads, Max Lord at death's door. Condition worses, Docs says. Da-da-da. That's it. Wave Rider flies off to the next Armageddon 2001 crosser. And it says, continued in Hawk and Dove Annual Number 2 in Justice League Europe Number 31. Which, by the way, was a big tip-off back then when it says to be continued in Justice League Europe number 31, because right then, Justice League Europe 28 was going to be on the shelf the next week. So why are they telling us to check out Justice League Europe in 3 months? If only this whole Captain Atom thing was something hinty, I don't know, whatever. But we all know that story. Anyway, so what'd you think of the issue, man?
And the fact that it's continued to Hawk and Dove Annual 2 is nothing really relative to this. That was just that the next Armageddon annual.
Well, actually, at that point, a month out, it may not have been a big deal, depending on how quickly they changed their minds. So what'd you think of the annual?
Okay, like I said earlier, this is one of my favorite comics that exists. As an introduction to the team, I don't know how well it works, but I loved it. I've always loved it. Now, this is very early in the Armageddon 2001 series after Superman and Batman. So the fact that Wave Rider is not really that strongly depicted on the cover, I think is kind of fitting with that because you might not entirely know what a Wave Rider is.
Mm.
But this issue, now that I've read, reread some of the Armageddons, this annual feels really different because instead of one hero's future, you have all these little nuggets of the future focusing on different characters. And I think the choice to weave those into one continuing narrative was important. It might not have worked otherwise. But yeah.
It's interesting because when I reread it, I didn't remember anything about it. And I get to the March Manhunter segment, right? And that led me to think the whole thing would be independent little futures. And it isn't until you get to the Ice story, which is like the third or fourth one down, that you figure out, oh, these are connected. They, one story does impact the next. So that was kind of a surprise to me.
Yeah, it's great. I do have some questions about the General Glory segment and the way that it fits in what happens after that. But other than that, it flows really nicely. So yeah, I love this book.
So I, one of the questions, I think you've actually already answered it for me, but one of the questions I had going in was, I was wondering if this story would make sense to someone that hadn't read Armageddon 2001 issue number one, because, you know, it's all these, I think they could understand the what if concepts, but the whole Wave Rider plot would be just boggling. But I guess as you, someone who came into this, it wasn't confusing. Is that fair?
Yeah. And there's a, you know, there have been enough comic books where a mysterious person, you know, goes to figure out the team and gives you just enough information to like maybe care a little bit about who they are. You do get all the bare bones facts in his inner monologues, but you honestly don't have to care.
Mm-hmm.
Wave Rider is a plot device, not a character.
Ooh,
in
that's
this
a good point.
Storyline. He is a conceit to make the annuals happen more than he is an actual story himself. Obviously, the first issue and the second issue of Armageddon 2001, where this starts and comes to a head at the end, you know, are the exception to that rule. But for the annuals themselves, Wave Rider is incidental. And so, yeah, I think that it works out just fine.
It's a fun way for them to do a bunch of what ifs, really, for DC, which they hadn't really settled on the Elseworlds concept at this point yet. Mm-hmm. And so this was a good way to do it. Now, let's maybe go segment by segment. Might be the best way to do it. So the framing sequence, like, I was not familiar with Steve Carr, the guy who did the framing sequence, at all. I had to look him up, in fact. He's got 35 story credits on Mike's Amazing World, which doesn't even include probably a whole bunch of independent stuff. So I would say, though, that his work was solid. It's not necessarily awe-inspiring, but I think it was solid. I think it was, you know, I think he did a fine job.
Yeah, I generally don't pay a lot of attention to art unless I have a hard time following it.
Okay.
But Wave Rider's look, I think, is, you know, very on point. Some of his posing is interesting. Like, he made the joke about the whole ballet pose coming on the opening splash. But like the zoom in on his face at the bottom of page two, that's is stark and interesting. And I think it works pretty well enough. I think his depiction of Elrond is pretty different from the one he had in the Lord of the Rings movies. But other than that, you know, it works. It's pretty good.
Okay. Now, the Martian Manhunter entry. I gotta say, like, I like some early Chris Sprouse stuff. I like later Chris Sprouse or whatever. This, I don't know what it is about it, is just excellent. Like, I really, really like this segment. It's only a couple pages long, and it's really just for a gag. But I think Chris Sprouse does an amazing job with the lines and, like, the old temple and the way Martian Manhunter looks. I think it's gorgeous.
This sequence has lived rent-free in my head for 30 years. And it's really the only specific moment from this annual that I remembered with any clarity when I went back to reread it the first time. But yeah, it's excellent. It's iconic. The depictions of the temple, the depictions of Jean Jones with the shadowed eyes, the expressions on the guy's face, it's all just excellent.
7 years ago, when you and I were talking about this issue, you asked for this issue, and then you said, well, I just want to make sure it's this one, and you literally sent me a picture of this panel of Jean Jones floating there and him going the Green Guru. That's what you sent me to make sure we were covering this one. So yeah, it has lived rent-free in your brain all this time.
And the Martian forms, you know, now that I have the context, we only saw this in his miniseries and like a couple of times since then. It's a rare depiction of the character.
And if you weren't paying attention to if you just read Justice League, right, and that's it, they probably shown this form twice, maybe three times in the whole run, you know. And so, yeah, it would be like, what am I looking at? Yeah, absolutely. So the next segment, the Guy Gardner segment. So let's talk about the art first. I want to talk about this because it's Derek Robertson. And this is the first time Derek Robertson's art has appeared in the Justice League book. And this is a big deal. Like, this is one of his earliest comic book credits ever. Now, if you're not familiar with the name, he's most famously known for Metropolitan and a little something called The Boys. Yeah, the Amazon Prime show, he was the artist on that. So he, you know, incredibly successful there. I loved him and fell in love with his work on New Warriors and his stuff on the Ultraverse. That's where I fell in love with his work. But yeah, this is some of his earliest comic work ever, and he's going to be working on Justice League Europe quite a bit coming up. So this is exciting. I think he's got some really nice, clean lines here. I think the art is really sharp. I mean, really, really crisp. And I thought he did a really nice job with it. And I especially love that the charcoal or pencil drawing at the end of the Daily Planet image of Guy getting pelted with fruit and stuff, where he got to do some grayscale stuff. I think it looks great.
His emotions and his character work in the faces is all really solid. And I'd like to think that he caught people's attention. So whenever they were contemplating a new artist for the JLA series, someone remembered this guy.
I like to hope so.
I like that Wave Rider is like, oh, a rude Green Lantern. That must be Guy Gardner.
Now that we've gotten done waxing Derek Robertson's car, we got to talk about the story elements of this Guy Gardner thing.
Mm-hmm. And
the whole cult of Guy Gardner. I mean, it's amazing where we sit. You give your comment and then I'll give mine.
So originally, I kind of found this whole cult of Guy Gardner to be rather implausible, but you know, whatever, it's a comic book. And then we had 4 years following 2016 when I realized that, oh no, this could totally happen.
I mean, he is exactly the example of a toxic masculinity influencer before it had a name. I mean, he mm-hmm. really, really is. I mean, it's all about being a jerk. It's all about treating people like crap. It's about the way he treats his female assistant. Everyone calls him master. He demands that his female assistant come by his house later, and he gets cut off, but presumably he's going to say in lingerie. I mean, this version of Guy is gross, and I don't ever want to see this version again, and I'm really glad this is an alternate future version, not the Guy Gardner we know. It's very disturbing.
The weird thing about these futures is, in a lot of ways, they feel like they're not necessarily 10 years in the future, but like maybe 10 months.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree.
So I kind of feel like this is just a 5 minute later extension of the Guy Gardner we have. Like if he had his way, this is the way tomorrow would be for him. And so it feels a little weird like that. But we get the bonk on the head, which of course harkens back to the first year of the comic. But I've also read early Thor issues, and I know that all you have to do is punch someone in a special spot in the back of their head, and they switch from good to evil or from evil to good. That's just the way it works.
So the question is, who cut the rope? Who tried to kill Guy Gardner? We never find out.
When I was recapping, I saw that. I was like, I don't remember that happening, but okay, I'll mention it now that I see it.
Yeah.
I don't know who cut the rope.
I mean, it could be any number of people. I'm sure Guy's made a lot of enemies, a long line of people, I'm sure. But it's interesting that it's a major plot point that they never bother to share.
Mm-hmm.
We'll always wonder. Thankfully, though, I am glad he's bonked on the head and becomes the nice Guy Gardner by the end.
Yes, because Tora deserves better than what the old Guy Gardner had to offer.
Well, and really, this version of Guy Gardner, it's more like a mixture between the mean Guy Gardner and the overly sappy version.
I did not care much for overly sappy. Now, I did not mind it as a story point. But yeah, this is more of a genuine Guy Gardner who's not hung up on his own awesomeness rather than a comedically sappy Guy Gardner.
It's a move towards the Guy Gardner we'll eventually get in his own ongoing series. A little bit. So I'm moving into the Blue Beetle segment here. We've got art by Marshall Rogers. So yeah, it really reinforces the whole subplot that they've been doing now for an issue or two about Ted being overweight. You indicated you feel like it's some fat shaming. I've been struggling. Like we did the last episode all about the Guy Gardner and Blue Beetle fight and about the weight subplot for Ted. And in that issue, we kind of came to the decision that we didn't feel like that issue was weight shaming or fat mm-hmm. shaming. Whereas this one, it definitely feels like they're leaning into it more, especially the costume part. The costume mm-hmm. was kind of the thing that got me over the hump. And said, it's not just trying to show someone dealing with the real world of depression and how weight can be a huge thing to cause a depression and make it worse. But then when they deal with the costume, it's like, okay, yeah, I feel like they kind of slipped into there.
And the idea of there being like this cyclic relationship between gaining weight, getting depressed, eating and gaining more weight, getting more depressed, that idea as an aspect of human psychology, I learned from this issue.
Oh,
in page 14, okay. Where he talks about what the heck's happened to me. I sit here like a lump, but eating too much, sinking into depression, eating more to get out of the depression, getting even more depressed because I'm so fat. What kind of life is this? That is an idea that I have carried with me. I have no idea how universal it is. And certainly there's a lot of discourse and a lot of efforts to undo that way of thinking in modern human society. But, you know, as a 1991 kid, I guess that's what happens. You get fat, you get depressed, you get more fat.
Yeah. Well, and there is some reality though, too. There's people who unfortunately don't seek help and they do spiral. And, mm-hmm. and so it's, in some ways, maybe it may have helped some kids in thinking, okay, I got to be aware that can happen. Or on the other, it could have, like you said, it had a negative effect. And at this time, they weren't as focused on it as we are nowadays, unfortunately.
I do feel like he goes from he goes beyond the sympathetic and just becomes plain pathetic. And yeah. I'm not sure if I like that far of a swing for the character, but like you were just saying, it does feel like an extension of what they were already doing with him. So it kind of works on that level.
And it's supposed to have a very downbeat, sad note. It's supposed to say that, you know, that this isn't Ted's future, but it's a possible future. And no one wants this for Ted is really what they're trying to say, which right. is why it goes into pathetic so badly.
I do want to mention, because I have a follow-up on it later, that on page 13, whenever Wave Rider is at the League, he's talking about the League dynamic. Mm-hmm. And it kind of feels like he's a superhero fanboy.
Oh, yeah.
From the future. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We know that about his character. So it feels like he's voicing this sort of traditional League fan perspective here, wondering why the Leaguers are arguing and having problems with each other. Like, he doesn't understand how this can be a thing.
Oh, so you think this is a little bit of the letters page, a little meta commentary going on there?
Maybe, but it's interesting because I feel like there's a part two to it later in the issue, which we'll come back to.
Okay. All right. Well, I got to mention on page 15, and I only noticed this right before we recorded, there is a panel where the overweight Ted Kord is looking in the out the window at the city, and his reflection back, you can actually see sort of the ghost of the Blue Beetle mask on him.
I noticed that circle before, but I didn't really pay attention. I didn't take the time to read what it was. You're right. He's looking at his Blue Beetle reflection.
It was really well done by Marshall Rogers. It looks really, really nice. And the big key to take away from this plot here is that the Beetle and Booster sold their superhero identities to a fashion company thinking they could get some money out of it. But then the fashion company said, okay, we now own the rights to it. You can no longer function as Blue Beetle and Booster Gold. Sorry, those are our you know, IPs. And so they actually lost the rights to be their own superheroes. And that plays throughout this entire annual. And it's an interesting concept.
They don't go into detail on the mechanics of how that happened, but I kind of took away the impression that Blue Beetle and Booster Gold did something or a series of some things that continued to sort of like disgrace the idea of superheroes or whatever. And so it was not just, oh, we have your rights, you can't be this anymore, but y'all have not been doing a good job under these titles, and we own them and are invested in them, and so we're not going to let you disgrace them any further. That's kind of the feeling I got from the story.
I think you're right, because Mr. Miracle is still allowed to use his identity. Now he has to pay a monthly payment to them, but he's still allowed to use the identity, and he's out there at least, you know, giving the appearance of keeping it together. Yeah, good point. All right, now, Ice, this is the big treat. Kevin Maguire back on Justice League. Mm-hmm. So exciting. I mean, just the faces, the line work.
The cats.
I was going to say, Bruce Patterson's not his typical inker, so, I mean, it's missing a little bit of some of the you know, the Joe Rubenstein magic, but still, it looks great. But yeah, all right, so let's talk about the cats. So I think you and I have different perspectives on this. All right, so you share your thoughts on the cats here.
Okay, so, you know, I was going to use the phrase cat lady to describe Tora, but I hesitate because I fear that people are going to think I'm saying it derogatorily. Like, we say that she's single, living at home, she's a cat lady. Like, people look down that, but I like cats. Cats are adorable. They're friendly. They're snuggly, except when they try to kill you. And most of the time, most cats are great. And I feel like Tora's personality would lend itself toward snuggling some fuzzy friends. So I feel like this feels like an acceptable, normal future for Tora if she were to abandon superhero life and abandon her, you know, Norwegian home and just go live in the suburbs.
I think it is a normal, logical extension. But I think what the creators are trying to say here is that she is a lonely, middle-aged cat lady because they show her as living in a suburbia by herself, single. She's got at least five cats. We see five in one shot at one time. It could be more. And she has, you know, the insinuation is that she's been pining away, waiting for Guy Gardner to need her. And so I don't like that depiction of her in that way. But then again, they are trying to show us worst case scenarios for all these characters. Not all of them, but a lot of the characters. You know, Ted Kord, worst case scenario. You know, Guy Gardner, Cult of Guy Gardner, worst case scenario. Ice, I think it's not a worst case scenario because worse things could happen. But it's a sad one. Like, I wouldn't want her to grow up to be the quote unquote old maid who's got a house full of cats. I think that's what they're trying to show us.
It's interesting how two people can look at the same lines and come back with different shapes. Because I see her living a normal, happy life. Guy Gardner's events come as a complete surprise to her.
Yeah.
She hasn't been pining after him. I envision her as realizing that Guy was not going to work, But now he's been struck on the head. Things are going wrong. And she realizes that whereas he didn't need her in 1991, now he does. And she can actually be there for him. And so she goes after him. Maybe it's just different ways of looking at it.
I like your interpretation a lot more. I do. I just don't think that's what their creators were going for.
Okay. But
either way, they do have a nice conversation here, her and Guy. And I like they acknowledge that Guy isn't just the jerk, nor is he just the nice guy. He's a combination of both. And that is the Guy Gardner that we will eventually see when he gets his own series. Not necessarily at first, but when Beau Smith takes over the series is when I really feel like for the first time, we see who Guy Gardner really is. We get a Guy Gardner that's a balance of the macho with still actually being a caring person. And I feel like this is a hint of what we might see someday.
I do want to backtrack just slightly. The setup for this sequence is the part two of that Waverider thing, because there's a part where he's sitting there thinking they really care about each other. They feel so deeply. They're not just the bigger-than-life heroes I've been watching on disc all these years. They're as frail, as fallible as the rest of us, and yet somehow they're all the greater for it. And so I kind of feel like this was, if earlier was Waverider representing the traditional fan, this is like a conversational response to that perspective.
That's fair. That's fair. And he's kind of a poet in his own head, too. I mean, his word balloons are very eloquent.
Yes. Waverider pontificates very nicely.
Well, again, it's great to see Kevin back in these pages. So
it
exciting.
Is. Yeah. So beautiful. So great.
So then we get Fire. So we're back to Derek Robertson again, doing a great job. My only criticism on the art in this one would be Ted Kord, the older, heavyset Ted Kord, looks a lot like Maxwell Lord for some reason. And I think the hair color plays a role into that. But otherwise, I think it looks great. I love the bit with Oberon proposing to Fire. It's so sweet. I think that led me to encouraging my girlfriend / fiance at the time and saying, hey, someday if I ever, surprise you with a ring, please just don't hug me. Just say yes or no. You know, I'd prefer to have a less ambiguous answer. This may have prompted me to do some of that. I don't know.
But would you agree that guys they want to already have a feeling what the answer is probably going to be?
Oh, absolutely.
Before they actually pop the question.
Absolutely.
I don't understand this storybook idea or this movie idea of like proposing out of nowhere with no context or previous conversation.
Right, right.
But, you know, of all of the things that feel like it shouldn't have taken 10 years to get there, Bees and Oberon's engagement is top of the list, because this should have been next month or 6 months from now, not 10 years from now.
I absolutely agree. This is a perfect example of what you said earlier about this should be 10 months, not 10 years. Yeah, it absolutely feels that way. And because they've already been building up Oberon and Fire, you know, and they've been building it up. They've been teasing it. We didn't get a full-blown romance yet. But yeah, so I'm with you there. But, you know, they had to work with the framework of Armageddon 2001. So
yeah.
All right, so in this same little story, we do find out that Fire is the one that has bought up all the JLI likenesses. And the more I think about it, I actually really like that, because it's the whole book started with this whole corporate mentality, right? With Maxwell Lord, the corporation, all of that stuff. So I think it kind of fits with that late 80s, early 90s vibe of the series.
I think it works well, and I think the idea of corporate superheroes is starting to sort of like get played with a bit more and more. Ever since the Avengers got like government backing or whatever, I think that idea has sort of been played with a little bit. It's been done a lot more since 1991. But, you know, having Beatrice sort of put her thumb in that pie makes total sense for her as a character.
And I like that they were forward-thinking enough to, you know, make her a female CEO. I like that.
Yes, yes.
Yep. So then Booster Gold. So we go to the future, and it's Dan Juergens is on the book. He's revisiting Booster. He's an integral part of Armageddon 2001. He's the perfect man to come back and draw this segment, which is great.
Y'all, that Booster Gold series is so good.
Oh, it was super fun. It was super great. I mean, we wouldn't have as much as I mean, that's what gave us Booster Gold, was that series.
And then it had a sad ending with his sister and everything.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But yeah, Dan Juergens back on this character for the first time, I guess, since that series, really, really good.
It could be. It just might be, yeah. Oh, well, no, Booster would show up in Superman once in a while, I think, if I remember right. I know a guy who read a bunch of Superman comics, so he probably could tell me for sure. But I think this may be the only issue of JLI so far, and I could be wrong, this is off the top of my head, but I think it may be the only issue of JLI where they acknowledge that Booster stole all his superhero technology from the future. Because right? I mean, we know that as Booster Gold readers, but if you just read JLI, you might not even know he's from the future. I mean, they don't really talk about it much, let alone talk about that he stole all that stuff.
And that he has a sidekick named Skeets.
Right? Yes, exactly. I know. Poor Skeets.
Now there's a storytelling conceit here that I always have a small problem with. You know, I do my Superman in Crisis podcast, which we didn't talk about earlier. Hello, everybody. I do a podcast called Superman in Crisis, and it is about the end of the pre-Crisis Superman. So I cover every issue of Crisis on Infinite Earths and every Superman adventure that was published alongside them through 1985, and then through the first half of 1986, going all the way up to whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow in June of 1986. So go check that out, Superman in Crisis, your favorite podcatcher, or on johnreadscomics.com. And in that podcast, I came across the point in time where Supergirl dies.
And, well, say what?
Right. And Supergirl dies in Crisis. And in the future, Brainiac 5 is reacting to it and mourning it.
Right.
And it just feels weird because to him, her entire life story was known from the day he first met her. And so to have Booster Gold sitting here reacting to the developments of Ted Kord. Now, granted, it shows he reads them, was obviously unfamiliar with them, but the next paragraphs are also on that poster. So he just stopped reading at the point in the poster where he no longer knew the plot so he could go back in time and get involved with it again. But like Ted Kord getting shot is written on that screen.
I don't know what you're talking about. That never happened.
I don't either. It's obviously a future.
Never happened. Never happened. Oh, gosh. You may be onto something there. I mean, he may not have the most dedicated attention span is what we're saying about our good friend Michael Carter. Whose name badge, by the way, I'm trying to look closely here. His name badge says Drooly Janitorial Services, by the way.
Oh, no.
So it's a play on drool and a play on Kevin Dooley. I never noticed that till this very second. That's hysterical. So, yes, if he had bothered to read the rest of the Blue Beetle thing, he would have learned a lot of things. But tragically, that's the nature of anytime you deal with a story from the future, it just doesn't work, right?
Right. Well, you know what I just now thought of? Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, never mind. That was my brain disconnected stuff. Never mind.
Superboy punched a wall and changed history anyway.
Well, he is in that bubble at this point. So, yes, could have happened.
Right. Now, there is a funny throwaway gag here where Booster's running through the hall of all these 20th century superheroes. And, of course, it's 20th century superheroes we all know already. You know, it's Tim Drake Robin and Beetle and Booster and Mr. Miracle and all that. And he's calling them all out. And he's like, Green Arrow, Creature Commandos, Martian Manhunter, Creature Commandos. And I thought that was also a funny thing. Until I remembered, J.M.D. Mateus, the man who wrote this script, created the Creature Commandos. So that's a fun nod he threw in there for himself, which is great.
You know who needs to be on the Creature Commandos?
Who's that?
Vermin. J.M.D. Mateus can take him over there. Just kidding.
No, I wouldn't mind.
I know people complain about it, but Child Within is a very important story to me. And I actually got to tell J.M.D. Mateus that at last year's Dragon Con.
Very wonderful. He is a wonderful man, and he's been kind enough to be on our show, on this show twice now. He's great, so... All right, so jumping forward to the Mr. Miracle segment, now art by Joe Phillips, who, of course, draws the Mr. Miracle book at this point, so perfect synergy there. I felt like, of all the segments, this was the funniest one for me personally. I mean,
this was great. And having Shiloh Norman there, because Shiloh Norman, if you're not reading Mr. Miracle, he is taking over to be the new Mr. Miracle while Scott Free goes off and does other things. I forget exactly what. But the idea that there would continue to be other Mr.'s Miracle... I kind of love that idea.
Oh, I agree. I love the Miracle Squad and how funny they got a chance to draw all these different costumes, which are super great. And you get to see a female version of it and one with a mohawk and all this stuff. And now Shiloh technically is part of the Justice League right now, although he only showed up for like one issue. But anyway, I do find it very funny how he's making fun of Shiloh as an example. Then there's a great bit where Barda is saying, she comes in, she's like, Contrary to appearances, I'm not a superwoman. And Mr. Miracle says, you are in my book. And she goes, well, your book was canceled years ago, which I found just so meta hilarious at that point.
That is great.
And then the repeated joke over and over about how Scott's going to break Ted out of jail, out of prison. I mean, I genuinely laughed hard at this segment. I thought it was really a lot of fun.
Well, the dynamic between Scott and Barda is very playful. She's long suffering with his shenanigans, but it's always fun to read. It's what made that book so much fun to read. Mm-hmm. And whenever they were apart for long stretches of the book, it's not that it was less fun, but there was definitely something missing. So having them just like going back and forth and her like, you know, saying her opinion, she's like, I just want to get my opinion out there, even though no one's going to listen to me. But then she continues to put it out there that, you know, they cannot break Ted out of jail.
You know, I'm gonna put this out there right now in the ether on the show and say, I love Justice League International. I do. Obviously, I've committed 7, 8, 9 years of my life to do this podcast. I love it. But you know what I will say? And I love all the eras I've read so far. I would say this book is always a little bit better when Scott and Barda are in it. Mm-hmm. There's just something magical about those two in the JLI book that I just wish they were in every issue. I understand they needed to take them away so they could have their own series. That's how great they are. But I think Justice League book is a little bit better when they're here.
I'll agree. I like Scott and Barda.
Yeah. Then we get the General Glory segment with Ty Templeton, which is fun. And this is where your question comes up. I believe it's the same thing I'm wondering about, which is the sequence of events. Is that what you're wondering about?
Yeah. So this sequence doesn't really seem to fit with the rest of everything, except for one person's passing comment to being back in the reformed JLI. But this almost feels like a throwaway dream.
I think what happened is, I think the Maxwell Lord segment, the one that's after this, takes place before this one. So if you were to switch the order and do the Maxwell Lord segment first, where Max comes back to the United States, he takes over B's company, then he goes again. And if you made the General Glory story the last one in the book, it actually flows just fine. Right. I think it's just happening out of order, which is confusing.
It is confusing, but it's also natural and to be expected from the way writer storytelling can see it. Like, who's to say he's going to get everybody, you know, in sequential days?
That's true.
So, yeah, I like that you point that out, because that does actually work out a lot better. Whom all do we have in the reformed JLI? Now, I've read the issues preceding this with the conglomerate, but I have not really committed those characters to memory, sad to say.
That's okay. No one has. Don't worry. Okay. Well, first off, I got to say, Ty Templeton is a master. So seeing him draw this, he is so excellent at using a minimal amount of lines to convey what he needs to. It's so great to see him back here. He was a fantastic addition to the JLI team, and I'm so thrilled. But yeah, so the team is General Glory, Booster Gold, Blue Beetle, Ice, Aquaman, which is interesting, Guy Gardner, and he's the nice Guy Gardner because he's got in front of him magazines for Home and Garden and Macrame Made Easy. Mm-hmm. And also, then from the conglomerate, we have Vapor and Echo, who were two of the female characters from the conglomerate. So that is the team, the new Justice League International.
And I never really twigged the fact that these were Ernie haircuts based on his sidekick, Ernie. I wasn't sure I really understood the whole Ernie haircuts line that's in the panel. But yeah, so Guy Gardner chose his haircut, retcon, because of Ernie, and everyone else is doing their haircuts based on Ernie because General Glory is leading the team. They just also happen to match Guy Gardner, who also had an entire cult of people with his haircut following him. So there's this recurring theme of Guy Gardner haircuts throughout the future. I think we're all going to be wearing them. And Shag, I hope you have your bowl picked out so that your wife can just buzz cut underneath it.
Considering I have to shave my head already because I'm so bald, I don't think it'll be difficult. It'll be a very shallow bowl.
Just a spoon.
Right. I was kind of surprised, you know, I raved about Ty Templeton, that they didn't get Linda Medley to draw this segment just because she drew the General Glory issues. So it just seemed it would have made more sense. But either way, I don't care. I was happy to see Ty Templeton draw anything. So, and it's... Here's how much of a goober I am for the JLI. Like, Max's speech to the UN to try and get them to reinstate the JLI charter, like, I love that speech. I thought it was really, really good. And then when I see the newspaper headline that says they're back with the Justice League logo, like, I got excited, which is ludicrous because the team didn't go anywhere. They're still here every month. But, like, I got excited. I'm like, oh, they're back. You know, just I'm a sucker for Maxwell Lord, you know, leading the team. I can't help it.
I'm looking ahead. So I got caught up in the Maxwell Lord segment.
Well, let's do that. So Maxwell Lord here is drawn by Lyndall Medley, hanging out on Kahooey, 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 which is pretty funny. And, you know, poor Herb, who's the nephew of the chief, is still being mistreated by the Kahooey, Kahooey, Kahooey chief. And let me tell you, that is an old joke. It's like a 3-year-old joke for this book. And that's heck of a callback that I'm surprised they stuck in there, but I'm glad they did. So what'd you think of this segment?
This was great. And now that you've clarified the continuity, it makes so much more sense, because Booster Gold, from his stealing the ship in the future, shows back up here and is like, you know, stumbling out into the present day. And it's like, we just saw Booster Gold in the previous segment. So who was that if this is Booster Gold? And the idea that that segment takes place after this segment, it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate the clarity on that.
Also, I wonder, with the time machine and everything, like, I can't help but my brain just goes to, like, whose time machine did Booster steal? Am I supposed to know whose that is? And it's like driving me crazy. I feel like I should know.
Because the sequence ended with him staring at a Legion cube, a right. Legion sphere. And right. He comes back in a cube.
And now he says he had to use some experimental thing. So, and it's fun. I'm kind of glad Linda Medley did draw this, because the Kooey, Kooey, Kooey stuff is almost like a cartoon. It's so silly. And the way the box bounces out and comes crashing, the time travel thing. So it's goofy. And Linda Medley's perfect for that. She's got such a cartoony style that, you know, she really may have been the best choice for this segment.
Can you imagine you're a woman and you're walking down the aisle of the airplane and you pass somebody and suddenly you hear, wow, miniskirts are back?
I imagine it happens more often than you think. Unfortunately, the reality of that is it probably happens very often.
Some sort of catcall or inappropriate comment probably happens. Yeah, you're right.
Yep. Yep. We both have daughters. I assume you've had conversations with her and I've had conversations with mine. And yeah, so.
Yep.
And the whole thing with the closed door, where they're behind the closed door, but you can figure out from the word balloons what's happening, and Max is using his whammy power on Fire to take control of her company, is pretty darn funny.
Yes.
It's horrible that he's manipulating. You know, we've talked about Max's power being absolutely horrible, but darn it, the joke still lands funny.
It does work well as a joke. I do not like it as a turn of events for Max's character.
Exactly. Exactly. Because unfortunately, if someone were to take the idea of Max manipulating people like this, like he did Huntress, like he does here, the only logical extension would be for him to manipulate a lot of people in an evil way and then perhaps turn on his old friends. And that's never going to happen. So...
certainly not after 2001.
Correct. Correct. Exactly. Yeah, I think that went through. But it's also cute, the last panel there with a guy in ice. Like, oh, that's nice, sweetie. And you see the picture, the kid picture on the fridge, and it says Daddy. And it's a picture of Guy Gardner. I love that so much.
Yeah, that's cute. Having recently reread the Superman annuals, the fact that Wave Rider has an effect on Max Lord, mm-hmm. and possibly changed the sequence of events because he could be dying now. That's interesting. A, it's interesting because the Superman annuals did that. They played with that same idea.
Oh,
that
okay.
Superman took subconsciously some knowledge of events from his interaction with Wave Rider that he was not aware of mentally, like consciously, and had a reaction to that and did things differently. Because for those who don't know, there's a sequence in one of the Superman annuals where Intergang sets off a nuclear bomb under the streets of Metropolis and blows up the city, which kills Lois Lane and all of his, you know, friends. At the end of that story, Superman does something that changes that sequence of events. And then later, when Intergang tried to do a nuclear bomb in their monthly Superman books, he averts it. So this idea that perhaps Wave Rider has changed things for Max Lord is interesting, but also it kind of lets the reader off the hook for missing this issue, mm-hmm. because now Maxwell Lord's situation is once again urgent and critical, and we don't know what's going to happen going into the next issue.
That's true. It does give you an out where if you missed it, you can just keep going forward. And I mean, it is, it's not a fill-in, but it is. It's all alternate futures. It's a big what if. So yeah, you don't have to have read this. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. And you know, maybe Wave Rider's impact, maybe that did change the future. And I don't know, hypothetically, maybe the person who was supposed to be Monarch doesn't turn out to be Monarch now because of Wave Rider's impact.
The entire Armageddon 2001 story is Wave Rider like changing the fact that he exists.
There it is. Perfect. So, because even I, in 1991, as a little comic shop shop, you know, little goer nerd had heard that it was going to be Captain Atom. All of us knew it. So, yeah, Wave Rider changed that future from happening, I think is what happened.
And I've heard, well, yeah, we don't need to talk about that now because you have a whole other half of this annual series to talk about. But the way the ending of this crossover fell out, I thought it was all just readers guessed and editorial got wind of it. But I've heard that there was an actual leak from DC offices of what was going on. And I don't know if that happened or not, but I don't think it necessarily needed to have happened. Readers guessed the ending and that got them rubbed the wrong way, I guess.
And I'm sure we will talk about this more on the back half. But yeah, I mean, they should have just left it as it was. Because, I mean, the readers guessed it. Great job, readers. You followed the clues. And right. Here's your reward. You were
here's
right.
Here's the ending. When you're watching a two-hour mystery film, if you figure out the ending, they don't just change it on you while you're watching. That would be really weird.
It's almost like watching Clue the movie with four different endings or whatever mm-hmm. it was. Mm-hmm. All right, so John, I got to ask, was this issue a win? You know, here we sit 7 years after you asked to be on the thing, 30 years after you read it. Is this comic a win still, or maybe is it a bit of a miss?
I guess I had to read it to be on the show, right?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
This is still, I mean, I don't even know why. I mean, I know why in general, but I couldn't point to very many specific things. This is one of my all-time favorite comics, and I think it's because Armageddon 2001 as a crossover has always had a special place in my heart because it was my first DC comic story. And the Superman annuals and this annual are the only ones that stayed in my Swiss cheese space that I call a memory. So yeah, this is one of my favorite books ever. And it was so awesome to get to reread it in the context of having read 261 issues of Justice League of America and 52 issues of Justice League, not of America. It's great. Love it.
I'm so glad that just knowing that you come to this with that amount of knowledge and just recently burning through all this stuff. It's so cool. And I'm just
by
so
the
glad.
Way, yeah. You and I need to have some Detroit conversations.
Oh, I love me some Detroit. I love me some Detroit. And most of it is, well, I won't say most of it. A lot of it is totally irrational and it's just in my heart. And you know, because there's a lot of good on those pages. There's a lot of bad on those pages. I don't care.
I would say it's irrational. I was reading it and I was like, wow, this is fun stuff.
Yay!
Yeah, it was pretty great. And honestly, it kind of felt like a proto JLI.
Oh, it was. All right, we can't do this right now because we'll talk for an hour on this. But I did have Jerry Conway on the show a year or two ago to talk about that very thing. And yeah, I told him that in a lot of ways, he cleared the deck so that JLI could happen by showing that you can have a Justice League that aren't the Big Seven. So, all right. Mm-hmm. But now, folks, we are going to have to step away from this gorgeous, gorgeous recap of this book and have to make a very difficult decision. Mm-hmm. We are going to have to select the
Pwahaha Award.
This is where we're going to nominate the funniest moment in the issue. Both myself and John will pick just one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Wahaha Award. All right, John, you're the guest. What is your recommendation?
I can't say there aren't plenty of runners-up, because there are lots of really solid moments in this issue. But I would be a complete and utter traitor to my 12-year-old self if I did not say that life is like an Oreo cookie. Guy outrages, screams, and he's like, maybe not. And then Wave Rider's confusion, Oreo cookie. Like that whole bit, I just love it. It made me laugh out loud. I had no idea of the context of John Jones and his Oreo cookie fascination. It's just like, Green Guru says life is like an Oreo cookie. What the what is that? It was amazing. I laughed. My brother laughed. It's like a memory I have with him from comics when we were kids. And yeah.
All right. Well, that is a fantastic nomination. It is not what I picked. I'll tell you what I picked, but then I have a follow-up statement immediately after that. I picked the bit towards the end, and I showed my hand earlier, towards the end of the Mr. Miracle segment, where he just keeps saying he's going to go free Blue Beetle. He's going to break him out of jail, and he keeps trying to rationalize, like, well, what if I break him out of jail and then sneak him back in before anyone knows? That would be amazing, right? You know, and he keeps going, and Barda keeps riding him, and it's really, really funny. That is my nomination. However, I am going to immediately turn around and hand it to you, sir, because that segment with Martian Manhunter is hilarious. The whole thing is a gag. The whole segment achievement is a gag. I mentioned, I think it's some of Chris Sprouse's best artwork ever. It's absolutely gorgeous. I love it. It's funny. It's kooky. It sets the tone for the whole thing. So yeah, without a doubt, Martian Manhunter and the Oreo are going to go home with a coveted Bwahaha Award.
Yay!
So congratulations, Jean. You have won the coveted Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride.
Thank you. I will. I appreciate that.
Oh, Anthea, wait, I said me? Jean, not John.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was just you were going French for a second there, you know.
It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, John, not Jean, I need to ask you a favor. Would you mind hanging around here at the embassy for a bit, just in case Wave Rider comes back? Because, I mean, I'm probably worrying for nothing, right? I mean, if he shows up here in the form of Captain Atom during Armageddon 2001, that shouldn't be any kind of bother, right? But either way, would you mind hanging around just in case he comes back?
Well, Wave Rider, that's their, like, a really big ship, right, that the Legends fly around. It should be really easy to catch if it shows up again. Don't worry, I will watch like a hawk.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that. Yeah, don't worry. We will. Like, I feel like there's doves of peace out there somewhere anyway.
No, she died.
Oh, my gosh. Still too soon. Still too soon. And don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show, John. After this podcast promo break, I am going to head over to the London embassy for the second annual of Justice League Europe.
In all his decades of publishing history, one event has affected Superman more than any other. Worlds lived, worlds died, and that was only the beginning. Superman was never the same. Presenting Superman in Crisis. Available weekly from January 3rd, 2022 at johnreadscomics.com.
Hey there, everyone. It's your old buddy Head. You know, Aaron Moss, over at the Head Speaks podcast. I'm still here, and so is my podcast. Starting in November, and for however many months it takes, we're going to put the Atom aside for a little while, and we're going to look at DC Comics Armageddon 2001 crossover. Join me and some other podcasting and internet friends as we take a look at, well, Armageddon 2001. A hero today becomes a villain tomorrow. Join us and find out who. On the Headcast Network, Armageddon 2001, along with a lot of my usual segments. Come, check us out. Available at head.headspeaks.com, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever else you find your podcasts at. Come, check us out.
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe Annual Number 2. From break, and I'm here with my second co-host for this episode. I knew if I was going to be talking about Armageddon 2001, that I really, really needed to get an expert on the show. But since I couldn't find any, instead I dug up an old buddy of mine who used to run the Armageddon 2001 Revisited blog. He's a podcaster, a coffee aficionado, and a friend. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Clinton Robison. Welcome to the London Embassy, Clinton. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Shag. How are you?
I am so excited to have you on the show. We booked you for this show a million years ago when you were back doing the Armageddon 2001 blog, which, by the way, thanks for doing that. It made doing the recap for the JLA issue a lot easier. So I appreciate you doing that, sir.
Yeah, you know, plagiarism is still a crime, right?
Well, you were pretty long-winded, so to be in my defense, I did have to cut it down by like half to make it work, which I did the same for this one too, by the way.
Well, okay.
Just so people at home know, you got a thing for coffee and a thing for comics. Is that fair to say?
What makes you say that? Just because, you know, I do a podcast called Coffee and Comics?
Which I've been on several times. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, I'm still waiting for the check to clear. Something about bouncing.
Yeah, let's just don't ask too many questions. See, I was fully expecting you to lay into me because, as I mentioned, I've been a guest on your show several times, but apparently you're unable to pick up the lead, and that was your opportunity to attack me for our friendship of, I don't know, 7 years now, where this is the first time you've been on one of my shows.
Well, you see, Shag, that's the thing. Like, the first time you came up here, when you weren't looking, I just put my hand on you and looked 10 years into your future to make sure you weren't going to, like, take over the world. But all I could see was, you know, just disappointment and more words. So, you know, at least I knew I was good for that 10-year interval. Now, however, you might want to keep your eye on this Ryan Daly guy.
He's trouble. But you do realize it has been almost probably 10 years since we met. I don't know the exact year it was. But yeah, I came out to your state and then drove, oh my gosh, the most boring road I've ever been on in my life just to come visit you. And yeah, so you could be Wave Rider and I could be Monarch. So we'll have to stay tuned and find out, I guess.
I mean, I gave you fair warning, Shag. I told you it's going to be 2 hours. And you're like, 2 hours is nothing. And then you're like, oh my God, it was like 8.
And then I had to drive it home too, by the way. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I got to ask you, because I ask everyone and it's in the script. What is your personal origin story with the JLI? You know, how did you discover the book? What made you fall in love with it? Or is this your first time ever reading a JLI book?
It's a good thing this is a time travel story, because this story right here gets a little timey-wimey too.
Okay.
Okay. So my first experience with the Justice League, outside of Super Friends, of course, was a little thing called the Detroit League.
Woohoo!
You know, a.k.a. the best time to be a JLA fan.
I don't know if you're being sarcastic or not, but I love that time.
I don't know if I am either, but I also love it.
Okay.
So, you know, thank goodness for Cousins' hand-me-down comics, right? I was young, not exactly ready to be a collector. I mean, you can't really collect when you're 5.
Right.
So, you know, fast forward a few years later, I come across this little book called Superman Annual Number 3. You might recognize it. You know, it's an Armageddon 2001 crossover.
Okay.
Gotcha. You know, where he's got the Captain Marvel cape and the gloves. And
Yeah. Dusty Evil, I think, drew that.
So, you know, in it, Superman becomes something of, well, let's admit it, a tyrant. So the League tries to take him down. He ends up killing Martian Manhunter, as one does, yada, yada, yada. The point is, I met Booster Gold and Fire in this issue. But, you know, imaginary future, imaginary characters in my mind. You know, you can't blame me. I was like 11. I was just seriously getting into comics at that point. So Fast forward just slightly after that, there's these magical little things on the shelf. You know, these little cardboard rectangular things called DC Cosmic Cards.
Oh, I love them so much.
Yeah. This is where I learned my imaginary characters were real. Mm. Well, as real as comics.
Right.
And you know, there was even a bigger team out there. You know, you had Fire, you had Ice, you had Booster, you had Beetle, and so on and so forth. But, you know, I'm still a Marvel kid at this point, so I'm just kind of like halfway paying attention to the trying to learn things. But, you know, they pique my interest, so I do start paying attention at the comics racks. I spot Justice League America, and it totally has characters I recognize on the cover. But by now it's 1993, and this is the Destiny's Hand story.
Ooh, okay.
AKA, you know, Dan Jurgens era.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome story, but hardly the JLI as you preach it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is definitely enough to get my interest ramped up over the top. So I keep buying League books. And of course, I'm like, okay, now I need to like go back and fill in the Armageddon 2001 gaps. And then it also dawned on me, hey, there's this thing called Mile High Comics that lets you order back issues for dirt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hello, first 6 issues of JLE.
Ooh, good choices.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, it didn't really click in my head that it was a comedy until issue 6.
Okay.
I was not always the quickest on the draw.
Oh, well, you know, you're on brand with that nowadays, too, so that works.
Hey, if anything, I'm consistent. So, you know, it's kind of like trying to figure out who my first doctor was. John Pertwee, Tom Baker, Peter Davison, they were all on the screen at the same time because of PBS reruns. So, yeah, how did I get introduced to the JLI? I'm not certain.
I have to say, I'm impressed with your pandering to the host by throwing Doctor Who references in there. That was clever. That was very clever. And very much appreciated, too, by the way. So we are going to do something a little different here. You know, a lot of times we will do a segment called the
Character Spotlight.
At the end of the show is where we usually do that. It's usually some character in there. Instead, what I want is Clinton to sort of catch us up on the Armageddon 2001 crossover. Being someone that did a blog for, you know, for quite some time covering all the Armageddon 2001 crossovers, you're pretty familiar with the crossover in general. So could you give us a spotlight on the storyline itself?
You know, a storyline is not a character, right?
Shut up and do it.
Whatever. I guess Armageddon 2001 is synonymous with the two characters that got created for it, so I'll let it slide this time.
Fair enough.
Armageddon 2001 was a 1991 crossover event that ran through the majority of the DC annuals that year. Guess what? The one comic series that probably would have dealt most with time travel, the Legion of Freakin' Superheroes, decided to mind their own darn business that summer.
Okay.
But, you know, we also got the two bookend issues, Armageddon 2001, numbers 1 and 2, a format that would get used again in the future with stuff like Eclipso, The Darkness Within.
Woohoo!
Why they don't still do that? I don't know. Maybe because everything every 2 months is an event.
Right. I mean, it's just nonstop, right?
So the entire premise of Armageddon 2001, in brief, we'll say, revolves around a future in which one of the DC heroes has become a villain named Monarch and has taken over the world. Dun, dun, dun. I'm still not 100% convinced it's not going to be you, Shag.
I have a comment about all that, but get through the recap and then I'll talk about that.
Okay, so Monarch rules in a very Orwellian fashion to the point where all information on Monarch's pre-tyrant identity has been erased from public knowledge. Only things known are that he was once a hero and that he came to power in 2001. Matthew Ryder has made it his mission to discover the truth, and through a series of plot-based experiments, he becomes the time-traveling superhero Wave Rider. He has come back to 1991, where he is sure he can find out the truth by touching the heroes and looking 10 years into their potential futures. In total, there are 14 issues to the story, plus a couple of epilogue stories in the Superman books. Haha. And addition to that, we get two other minis with the Armageddon branding.
Blah! Sorry.
Hey.
They were not good. They were not. I know what came out of Inferno, but Alien Agenda and Inferno itself, they were not good.
That's what I was like. As much as I hate Inferno itself, without it, you do not get your beloved Mike Parabek Justice Society series.
We would have got the JSA anyway. It's just that's how they chose to bring it back in all places. Anyway, I digress. Please continue.
The storyline was intended as a way to take the supposedly unpopular Captain Atom off the board for a while. But as we all know by now, the news got leaked, last minute changes happened, and instead of Captain Atom, we got the also super equally popular hero, Hawk.
So Hawk was revealed to be Monarch. Of course, it makes perfect sense, right?
To be fair, as a new comics reader coming in, I read Armageddon 2001 number 2 and was like, God dang it, Hawk and Dove must be super important to the DC universe.
Yeah, right.
I still love them, though, dang it. So instead of Captain Atom ruling our futures with an iron fist, he gets to bounce around after Armageddon 2001 throughout history in Armageddon Alien Agenda, fist-fighting Monarch, and running for dinosaurs, and getting gunfights, and, you're just as bored as I am. So, you know, by the time Captain Atom gets back to modern day and interacts with the League again, post-breakdowns, he's back to working for the U.S. government, or some such nonsense until Zero Hour happens and he and Wonder Woman get all pissy at each other and decide, no, screw you. Captain Atom's like, I'm going to form my own Justice League with Blackjack and hookers.
It's a pretty good description for Extreme Justice. That's fair.
Which is exactly why Ronnie joined up. You
exactly.
Do not tell me otherwise.
Ronnie Raymond came for the hookers and blow. That's exactly right.
But then again, after that, Monarch also shows back up. Who is instead also now Nathaniel Atom? Don't get me started on that. The retcons on that alone are just mind-boggling. And then by the time you get Crisis and 52 and...
Yes, it's retcon upon retcon upon retcon, which is sort of funny because it's time travel, so it almost works, but it gets ridiculous after a while.
Would have just made more sense if they had been like, hey, it's Perdegaton or the Time Trapper or something.
Right. But. So a couple big picture thoughts. First of all, so Wave Rider is from the year 2041, if I have that right, because he said he's from 50 years in the future at that point. So he comes from 2041 back to 1991 to see what's going on in 2001. Follow the path there. But sadly, that means that future where Monarch controls everything and Wave Rider's, you know, is born essentially, that's only 18 years away from now. And the flying cars and everything they had there, we ain't got that. I'm just saying.
So what you're saying is you would have preferred had Monarch taken over because, like, everything would be nice and clean and technologically advanced?
I mean, there's something to be said for that. So you tried to throw shade and accuse me of being Monarch. But if you really think about it, so who's the person who betrayed everyone? That was, you know, who, a main focal point of the DC Universe who betrayed everyone in the early 2000s? I'm just thinking it might be Dan DiDio. Just saying. Glad you see things my way.
I mean, I'm not going to say you're wrong. Because, I mean, at this point, you know, like, who hasn't been the time trapper, so...
Right. Well, I'm just saying, he was part of the decision making to kill Ted Kord, so, you know... Anyway, so thank you so much for that summation and character spotlight, Clinton. I really appreciate it. Helping put us in the picture on Armageddon 2001. Thank you, sir.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, let's get into this, folks. This is Justice League Europe Annual Number 2, published by DC Comics, cover dated 1991, on the shelves August 27th, 1991. Now, to be fair, we are sort of cheating in our coverage here, folks. We are jumping ahead a bit because, you know, we just covered Justice League Europe Number 28, right? But in order to cover both Armageddon 2001 annuals in the same episode, I am jumping ahead by a few months. So this annual comes out actually after Justice League Europe number 30. So we're kind of 3 months into the future and a little further into breakdowns. But again, I don't think that that's critical as we're covering this. And it just makes sense to cover Armageddon 2001 together.
You know what is critical?
What's that?
Maxwell Lord's condition.
Oh, ba-dum-bum. Shh. Don't forget to tip your waitresses, folks. Clinton will be here all week. So cover price is $2, 8 shiny quarters. Cover is by Kevin Maguire. Woohoo! And, by the way, inked by Bruce Patterson. Not that you can tell that anywhere on the internet. The only way you can find that out is if you Google the original art for this cover. You can see Bruce Patterson is credited on there, but nowhere else. So, Clinton, you want to describe the cover for us?
Sure. I only have one question, Shag.
Yep.
Why does this say Justice League Europe when this is clearly the Justice League of Oklahoma?
Why Oklahoma? I see two cowboys. Is that why?
Okay, bear with me now.
All right.
Starting in the upper right here and going counterclockwise.
All right.
We have an electrician.
Lightning Lad, sure.
We have a hot blonde that is way too good for him, and she thinks she knows what everybody's thinking.
Saturn Girl, fair.
You've got a guy that's doing his own research.
I'm assuming that is Elongated Man?
Yes.
Okay.
You've got a washed-up sports star.
Ouch! Yes, Cosmic Boy.
You've got a caveman.
Anthro, that's you, right? Oh, wait.
Yeah, you've got a cowboy.
Batlash, got it. Yeah,
you've got a literal demon.
Etrigan, yep.
Yeah. You've got a futuristic cowboy who probably really likes Harley Davidson.
That would be Hex from the post-apocalyptic future, yes.
And you've got a guy right in the center that is clearly a ride or die patriot.
Yes, General Glory. That is a pretty good description of Oklahoma. Okay, all right, that's fair. How long did you work on that?
About a week.
It all paid off. Well done, sir. Well done. Yes, so it is a very bizarre cover. It says, is this the League of Future Past? And even says, guest starring Anthro, Batlash, The Demon, Cosmic Boy, Saturn Girl, Lightning Lad, Hex, General Glory, and Ralph Dibny, the world's greatest detective. Clearly, the only person on this cover that's actually part of this team normally is Ralph Dibny, so that's a little strange. But it's still a fun look. I mean, it's all posed up just like Kevin Maguire always does. You know, in fact, this is the seventh time the Justice League has aped this pattern. You know, we got the very first issue of Justice League by Kevin Maguire. You get Justice League number 24 by Kevin Maguire with all the new members. You get Justice League Europe number 1 by Bart Sears. You get Justice League Annual number 4, which was the Justice League Antarctica cover. You get Justice League Quarterly number 1, which is the conglomerate cover. You get Justice League Europe 26, which is the Starro cover, and now this one. So seven times they've done this, and it's still always funny to me.
I wonder if he ever got tired of drawing this, you know, this whole pose.
He's still doing it. I mean, he does it for commissions all the time. So maybe he is, maybe he's not. I don't know.
Well, I mean, maybe he's just one of those guys that's like, hey, I found the thing that works, and I'm going to lean into it, and I'm going to ride it till I can't.
It is one of the most famous cover designs in comics of all time. I mean, you got, like, Action Comics number one, you know, Crisis number seven, this. I mean, there's these iconic covers that people, you know, repeat over and over and over, and this is definitely one, because it's not just him. I mean, they've done it on Transformers. They've done it on Kentucky Fried Chicken comics. They've done it on everything. So it's this gets redone over and over and over.
Kentucky Fried Chicken comics?
I'm not making that up. If you compare this to other Justice League previous covers, so they've got, like, Etrigan is in the place of Guy Gardner, you know, or Metamorpho, whichever way you want to look at it. And General Glory is in the place of Batman and Captain Atom, and those kind of work, actually. Like, I kind of like those in those places. They make a lot of sense. So who's your favorite oddball character on the cover here? Because there's some weird ones in here.
You mean, like, as far as, like, just looking at the cover? Or
yeah, just in the cover.
What the heck. I'm going to go with Ralph and General Glory because, like, you know, General Glory would be the one character who would probably actually fit most, you know, other than just Ralph. But,
okay. You
know, that's the one that Ralph's choosing to inspect.
Okay. I think I like Batlash the best because he's tipping his hat and he's like, howdy, folks. But the most incongruous ones, the ones that just catch my attention are Anthro, the cave boy, right? Because you can see his axe in front of Cosmic Boy. And then just Hex. You know, Hex there in that ridiculous futuristic outfit. Because, I mean, by this point, you know, the Hex series had been over for many years. And people were trying to forget it. Like, you know, DC was embarrassed by the Hex series. So the very fact that Hex is even in this makes it even funnier. So, because, again, Keith Giffen, I think, is realizing that, oh, no one wants to ever see this version of Hex again. Of course I'm going to put it in here. So I love that. Now, this is, of course, in one of those covers that doesn't depicting a scene that doesn't actually happen in the comic, just like the JLA cover this month. But that's OK. It's a lot of fun. And interestingly, if we mentioned earlier, Justice League America cover did have a reprint. This one does not get a reprint. So I guess by this point, they were either printing enough of them or the sales in Armageddon 2001 had cooled off. I'm not sure.
Well, I figure, you know, since this is the last piece of the crossover right before the other book end.
Oh, is this one important? Oh, I didn't notice. Okay. All right, Lena, let's get inside of this book. Now, similar to the Justice League America book, there are tons of different chapters in here, and each chapter is going to be drawn by a different person, so I'm going to call out all of that for you here. So, plot and breakdowns by Keith Giffen, script by Gerard Jones. The framing and bridging sequences are, once again, penciled by Steve Carr, just like in the Justice League America issue, but this time they're inked by Randy Elliott. Now, here's all these other future sequences, right? And they're all inked by Randy Elliott. You've got or at least most of them are. Catherine Colbert sequence was penciled by Russell Braun. The Rocket Red sequence is penciled by Marshall Rogers. The Power Girl sequence is penciled by Linda Medley. The Metamorpho segment's by Keith Giffen. The Silver Sorceress segment is by John Beattie with inks by Michael Golden. Ooh, Michael Golden. Crimson Fox has pencils and inks by Randy Elliott. The Blue Jay sequence has pencils by Kurt freaking Swan. Yeah, Kurt Swan's in this thing. Elongated Man has pencils by Ty Templeton. And there's a sequence at the end with a cat who's the artist is not credited in there, but I'd like to give a shout out to the folks over on Facebook and the Justice League International group. They helped me out, and as well as some folks on Twitter. They're all 100% confident that the cat segment is penciled by Marshall Rogers. Letter is Michael Heisler, colorist is Gene D'Angelo, assistant editor is Kevin Dooley, and editor is Andy Helfer. You want to start us off, buddy?
Why would I do that?
Because I told you to.
Oh, well, you know, since it's in the script.
Yep.
Okay, so our story is called Too Much Time. The story starts out with the Leaguers actually getting along and socializing.
Dun, dun, dun.
Of course, you know, they've been brought together thanks to Maxwell Lord getting shot more times than JR. And having, you know, less than a stellar reaction to Wave Rider over in the JLA annual. Good job, buddy. Fire wastes absolutely no time in letting Dimitri know that she's getting thirsty for a white Russian, if you catch my drift.
Oh my god.
With news that Max is at least, you know, stable, the JLE head back to Paris, minus Captain Atom, who has to stay behind and ponder if he's even coming back at all. Back at the Paris embassy, Sue explains that Superman and Wave Rider are waiting for our heroes. Supes explains the entire premise of the crossover of Armageddon 2001 to everybody, and despite some hesitation by the Leaguers, they agree to let Wave Rider check into their futures. Oh, and we see the mysterious Mr. Bigger and his crew watching everything through the eyes of Power Girl's cat. You know, like one does. The first to be scanned is Catherine Colbert. In Catherine's future, we see her dealing with Interpol, referencing the League fallout from the JLA annual, and assembling the League's grocery list. As she departs for her shopping trip and complains to herself, the embassy disappears in a massive whoomp, as in whoomp there it ain't.
God.
Leaving Catherine to say she'll probably have to fix this mess. Back in the present, Wave Rider is a bit startled and confused by the future he's seen. Catherine excuses herself to go do monitor duty, and Rocket Red volunteers to be next. In Camelot, yes, that Camelot, Dimitri appears between two jousting knights. Camelot, isn't that supposed to be 10 years in the future, not several centuries in the past? Just roll with it, kids. Rocket Red manages to take out both knights and their horses, winning him knighthood in the court of King Arthur, and winning him the jealousy of Merlin. So we see many adventures of Sir Dimitri, not the least of which is facing down a dragon, hey, 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 but he's still a lonely, lonely man without his wife and kids. Merlin's jealousy gets the better of him, and one night summons Etrigan the Demon, who sadly makes quick work of Dimitri. Back in the present, we get another confused reaction from Wave Rider. Get used to it, folks. This happens a lot. Power Girl insists on being the next one up, but careful where you touch. London, the Blitz. That's right, World War II. Power Girl pops into the scene just in time to save a mother and son from being crushed by a falling building. But then she hears a voice. No, the voice. The voice of liberty and justice. That's right, it's General Glory. And he's accompanied by his faithful sidekick, Ernie, who is clearly in the middle of puberty and has some raging hormones.
Yeah, he does.
Kara wants to get some sense of things and plans to seek out the Justice Society and get away from General Glory. But, you know, General Glory also tries to make sense of things, and in trying to talk to Power Girl, Ernie ends up getting himself killed. Looks like we're gonna need another Ernie! So, through what I can only assume is some serious smooth talking on General Glory's part, Power Girl becomes the new Ernie, bowl cut and all. Cut back to the embassy. Same reactions. You know the drill. Metamorpho's turn now. Pop into the post-apocalypse, or so it seems. Rex arrives in time to stop some guys in radiation suits from gunning down a man covered head to toe. The man removes his mask, revealing a scarred face, and both exclaim that the other is uglier. The two head off to find some booze while Metamorpho makes some meta commentary about Mad Max movies. Rex and Hex, soon to be best buddies, I'm sure. Back to the present. Lather, rinse, repeat reactions. The Flash more or less volunteers to be next, but no need. Wave Rider has already checked on Wally over in his own title. It doesn't sit too well with our local speedster. I'm not sure if it's because of the not needing to be checked twice or just being checked without his permission, but whatever. We'll move on to the Silver Sorceress.
All right, well, I'll take it from here. And yes, I blatantly cribbed my recap from the Armageddon 2001 Revisited blog. So thank you to whatever nameless freak dedicated their life to creating that blog.
God, yeah, who would waste their time looking at an event 25 years later?
Right, exactly. All right, so next up is Silver Sorceress's future, and she is surprised to appear in the middle of a swamp. Hoping to find her bearings, she wishes to spot like an animal of some sort, but comes face to face with a giant dinosaur. She attempts to conjure a spell to shrink the beast, but Anthro the caveman intercedes to battle the dinosaur. With nothing to do, Silver Sorceress simply sits down further away for a rest, while a young cavewoman sits down beside her and the two have a discussion of sorts. Up next is Crimson Fox. She volunteers as she has no problem being touched, which makes Wave Rider a little uncomfortable. And we're all shown the Old West, and the cowboy Batlash is playing cards. He wins with four aces, but lands in trouble as more aces tumble out of his sleeve. As the other card players figure out he's been cheating, they pull their guns, but then Crimson Fox surprisingly materializes in the middle of the table. She and Batlash jump out the front window as the other players open fire. After a brief chase, Crimson Fox soundly thrashes the other cowboys. Batlash thinks this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Back in the present, Wave Rider's confused by why all these visions take place in other times. Something must be wrong. Next up is Blue Jay, who appears during a tryout session for the Legion of Superheroes. His sudden appearance astounds the Legionnaires. The three founders offer him immediate Legion membership based on his ability to teleport. He reveals, however, that his power is actually to shrink and grow wings. They unanimously reject him, but give him a flight belt as a consolation prize. Blue Jay is then approached by Polar Boy, who asks Blue Jay to a meeting of the Legion of Substitute Heroes. Needless to say, Blue Jay is unimpressed. Next up is Elongated Man, and he appears in London of 1895. Ralph's sudden appearance results in the accidental capture of Professor Moriarty, much to the chagrin of Sherlock Holmes. Instantly famous, Ralph spends his time hobnobbing with London's top writers and men of intellect. Later, H.G. Wells shows Ralph his secret project, a time machine, and Ralph eagerly offers to help. Then, back in the present, Captain Atom shows back up at the embassy. As Wave Rider's about to examine Captain Atom, Power Girl's cat rubs up against Wave Rider. We see the cat's future where Mr. Bigger's goons sneak into the basement of the embassy, and they are there after Mitch Wacky's time machine. The cat, however, remembers these goons attacking him back 10 years ago in the previous issues. The time has come for revenge, and the cat attacks the men. In the scuffle, one of the men decides to shoot the cat who's gotten onto the time machine. The resulting gunfire causes the embassy to disappear into time, leading to the events that we've seen throughout the issue. Back in the present, Wave Rider examines the cat's camera eyes, and Mr. Bigger is forced to cease his surveillance. Now the time has come. Wave Rider approaches Captain Atom, places his hand squarely on the chest of one of the most powerful superheroes of the 20th century, and prepares to examine what possible future this man has. And with that, it ends with contact. To be concluded in Armageddon 2001 number 2, on sale soon.
Yay!
And of course, as we all know, that story goes on to show that Captain Atom is in fact Monarch. So there we go.
And the DC Universe was no more.
There we go. All right, buddy. So I got to ask you, what do you think about this issue?
Oh, I love this issue. This is forever one of my favorites of the Armageddon 2001 crossover issues. Oh, man, where to begin with it? Where to begin?
Well, we're not going to go line by line just yet, but we're about to. But big picture, what about it makes you love it?
Oh, it's, well, of course, you know, time travel stories I'm always a sucker for, but it's really humorous. It's everything stands out. Like, every character has their own voice, and it just pops. With no pun intended of everybody popping.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the pop is the onomatopoeia whenever they appear in time. All right. Now, Clinton has no idea what I'm about to say, so this is going to come as a surprise to him. And Clinton, you and I have been friends for a long time now, so I think it is fair to say you know when I'm kidding and when I'm not, and please know that I'm being serious, that I absolutely respect your opinion, and I'm not here to sway your opinion, and I appreciate that you love this comic. I did not. I think it's possibly only once or twice in the history of this show that I've said that. I do not like this comic book, this particular issue at all. Like, it's got some great art and it's got some fun jokes, which I'm going to spend the rest of this episode highlighting. So I'm going to say a whole bunch of positive things about it. But overall, for me, this is a really, really angry comic book. I don't know if you got that vibe or not, but like, especially in the present, all the characters are really angry. I mean, would you agree with me at least on that part?
For the most part, yeah. I'll agree with that.
And again, I'm not trying to sway you. I'm not. I want you to love what you love. So don't think I'm trying to poo-poo your opinion at all. I'll go through my thoughts real quick here, and then we'll get into the fun stuff. Let me get the ugly truth, or my ugly truth, out of the way here. Like, so everyone's angry. Everyone is pissed off at Wave Rider. And like, but Superman's there vouching for him. Like, Superman is. And they're all still being jerks. You know, like, Power Girl is way over the top angry. Way, way over the top. And this is the beginning of the dreaded diet soda subplot.
Okay, I wondered because it comes up like 3 times.
Yeah. So this is where it starts. She keeps fussing about how she wants a diet soda. She wants a diet soda. And what later is revealed, I think several issues down the line, is that her drinking diet soda is what makes her so mean. It's a horrible... And we had Dr. Jennifer Swartz-Levine on a previous episode to really talk about in depth, so I don't want to go into it here. But it's a really terrible thing, and it's tied to a lot of sexist issues, and it's really bothersome. And the way you read the story, there is no diet soda pictured in the art at all. It's not in the plot. It's just in the script. So that's really coming from the scripter, who then goes on to become the writer of this book and really plays that up. So I think it's their particular thing, and I am not a fan. And then even stepping away from that, like, I like Kara when she's tough. I want Kara to be tough. I don't mind when she gets angry for good reason. Like, I like it when she plays what's, you know, the quote unquote straight man. You know, she doesn't take anyone's crap. You know, people are scared of her because they know that she's going to, you know, shout them down when they're being stupid. But this is just angry for anger's sake. Like, she comes off like a caricature and like a bad stereotype. I promise I'm almost done with my kvetching, and then we'll talk about fun stuff. So the other thing that bothers me is, like, the future segments, you know, all of them individually are fun, right? I mean, they're pretty funny, actually. But the characters have, like, no agency in these things. Like, there's no decisions that they make that influences the story. It's just, like, stuff happens around them. Like, Catherine Colbert's future, stuff's just happened around her. Same thing with Silver Sorceress is the most egregious example. She just sits down. She has nothing to do in that story. Blue Jay's that way. Power Girl's that way. Even Rocket Red, to some extent, is. The only characters who really influence the outcome of their future was Metamorpho, Elongated Man, and Crimson Fox. No one else did. And the other thing, too, is, well, the futures were funny, it could have been any character. There's no reason why Rocket Red had to be back in Camelot. They could have dropped any character into that. They could have dropped any character into the dinosaur thing for Silver Sorceress. They could have dropped any character in the Legion of Superheroes. It has nothing to do with the individual characters. Whereas in the Justice League America annual, all of those futures were tailored for those characters. Like, that was specifically about them. These just seem random. It almost seemed like, you know, Keith Giffen wanted to play with Anthro, and he wanted to play with Hex, and he wanted to play with Legion, and he wanted to play with, you know, all these fun bits, and it just found something that made it all fit. Now, I'm not saying that's what Keith did. I don't really know. But that just kind of went through there in my head. And the confusion about why they're popping into different times, like, I didn't feel like they explained that enough. Like, when you get to the end and you know that it all happened because of Cat, it all makes sense. So, like, when I read this the second time and I read it the third time, it all made perfect sense. But, like, I didn't feel like they set up the mystery enough. It's more like just here's a bunch of random crap happening in... Yeah, Wave Rider would have one line where he's like, huh, why is that? And that'd be about it. I just didn't feel like they developed it enough. So the bottom line is, I feel like it was a very, very angry written comic book. And pure speculation, maybe the writers at this point were angry about losing Captain Atom. I mean, because it's been their character for 3 years now. And now DC's telling them, sorry, you lost your team leader. I mean, maybe they're angry about it and they're just taking out the frustrations in the script. I don't know. So again, I'm not trying to change your mind. And I'm going to spend the rest of the episode talking about the things I did like, but I had to get that off my chest. Feel free to rebuttal or not, whatever you want, buddy.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Shag. And I'm happy you're letting me be the new host of JLI from now on, because you hate everything. And oh, sorry. No, what?
Yeah, sure. I always say find your joy. I did not find my joy in this comic book, unfortunately.
That's valid. I can see your point. And this is how long before Giffen's off the book?
So technically, Giffen and DeMatteis, well, at least on Justice League Europe, it's Giffen. He's only on the book for about 6 more months. And then or maybe even 5 months. And then he's gone. So it is very much the end of the Giffen era. And right now they're also writing this giant breakdown storyline. And so now the flip side, though, the JLA annual was great, you know, so it could be that more effort went into that one. I don't want to say effort, because this took a lot to put together. It's not like this wasn't worked on by a lot of people and put together very skillfully, and a lot of people worked very hard. And again, I've got a lot of nice things to say about it. I'm just saying as a full, complete package, it didn't hang together for me.
Okay, so here's a question.
Yep.
Do you think the script for this was written before or after the Captain Atom leak?
I think it was probably written before. I think, other than Armageddon 2001 issue number 2, I think everything was written before the leak. Because, I mean, even if you read the Hawk and Dove annual, clearly Hawk is not Monarch, right? And so they had to scramble and change everything for Armageddon 2001 number 2.
I have notes about the Hawk and Dove. Short version is, there is a way to read the Hawk and Dove annual where they basically say that just by looking into everyone's futures, Wave Rider is already eliminating those futures that he sees and is manipulating futures to be different. So technically everyone that he has looked at could still potentially be Monarch.
Okay.
Which may have been one of those, like, last second, hey, you know, we went back and edited this 2 days before publication to say this. But
right. Yeah, you know prize that well. Now, this did come out, interestingly enough, about the same month as the last issue of Captain Atom. And the last issue of Captain Atom ends with this huge battle between Captain Atom and his evil doppelganger, which is, by the way, tied to Firestorm's evil doppelganger, but forget about that. Anyway, so Captain Atom and this evil doppelganger, they literally fly at each other. They smash into into each other, and there's a big cloud of dust, and it ends with just Captain Atom standing there. He doesn't say another word, though. He doesn't speak for the rest of the comic, and he just flies away. It's very weird. It leaves the reader sort of uncomfortably ambiguous, and it leaves you thinking that perhaps Captain Atom might be infected with a little bit of evil from that doppelganger, which then leads you directly to here and to in Armageddon 2001, number two. So I think everything was designed for it to be Captain Atom. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it could have easily just been, hey, yeah, it's Captain Atom. And then 6 months later, okay, he's done being Monarch.
Right.
We're going to stick him in DC superhero rehab.
Exactly. Exactly. So could have been Heroes in Crisis. Anyway, let's get into this a little bit here. So I've got some thoughts on the issue. You chime in here as we go as well. So first off, I do think it's a bit of a stretch to think that 10 years in the future, this exact team composition would still be together. Because like if you look at how the roster's changed in just the last 3 years of this book, you know, there's no way these characters are together in 10 years. So John Wilson said it in the first half of the show. He said these feel more like 10 months later rather than 10 years later. And I think that's fair. That's fair. And that's not a knock. I mean, obviously, they have to work with material that's given with them in the Armageddon 2001. But it does feel like this is like more 10 months than 10 years.
Oh, yeah. And especially since they're all wearing the same costumes and everything.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It's like, good Lord, Power Girl's changed her costume, what, 3 times since the book began?
Well, no, just one time
here.
Oh,
just the one.
But,
okay. And she's going to change it at least one more time? Two more times?
She changed at least...
Anyway, before 0 hour.
Yeah, she definitely changes it for the worse. So, yeah.
Why am I the only one who likes that costume?
The blue one with the headband?
Yes.
You are the only one that likes that costume. Okay, well, there you have it.
I don't like the white and gold.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, that would actually be my least favorite Power Girl costume.
Okay. If you want to be derogatory towards the yellow and white costume, you could call it the sunny side up egg costume if you want, but because it does look a little bit like that. But looking in here, you know, it's really cool that they got all these artists, just like they did in the Justice League America book. They've got a different smattering of ones here. I am kind of surprised there's no segment drawn by Bart Sears, and I'm kind of surprised there's no segment drawn by Derek Robertson. Both of them at this point had been JLE artists, and they're not in here. It's fine that they're not, but I was kind of surprised because they did get Kevin McGuire back. Now, to be fair, you know, Bart Sears has only been off the book for like 2 months or 3 months or something at this point, but still, it would have been nice to have him.
Oh, yeah.
So, looking at like the framing and the bridging sequence stuff, you know, with pencils by Steve Carr, I do like the shading that Steve Carr does here. There's some really good use of shading, like with Martian Manhunter, with Captain Atom, things like that. It looks really, really nice. So, you mentioned it in your recap about Fire being thirsty for Rocket Red. What's going on there? Like, what is that about? Because they were teammates for like a long time on the JLA before Justice League Europe even existed. So where is this coming from now all of a sudden?
I'm specifically curious, does she not remember that he is married?
Right.
Like, I mean, whatever they, you know, two consenting adults are okay with, I guess, but... I don't think Dimitri's wife is going to appreciate it much.
No. And again, they were teammates for a long time. So it does feel incongruous. Like, I don't have an explanation for it. It didn't make sense, though. But I was going to move on to the Catherine Colbert segment, unless you got any more on the framing sequence.
But yeah, flipping back through it, God, Power Girl is just angry from the get-go, isn't she?
Yeah, she's ridiculously angry. And this is also, again, where the Diasota joke starts.
Right before we lead into the Catherine scene.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to like point out how cute is Sue with a ponytail.
I love the ponytail. She's adorable, and it's the artists are always in a interesting situation where they have to be careful to make sure that Catherine Colbert and Sue look different, because here you have two beautiful brunettes that just wear regular people clothes, and in comic book art that can be difficult to distinguish between the two. I mean, how many times have you seen a character and gone, is that Lois Lane or is that somebody else? I don't know. And so here, especially when they're in the frame together, the artist has to work to make sure they look different, and doing a ponytail is a great way to distinguish between Catherine and Sue, and I love it.
Also, I'm going to ask you, because I am far from an expert on JLI, Mr. Biggers.
Oh, okay. So many issues ago, Mr. Biggers hired a bunch of thugs, or his thugs, whatever, to go capture the cat, Power Girl's cat, and they put in these like camera eyeballs in the cat. And so the cat has been watching the JLI all this time, and they've been collecting information. Mr. Biggers is essentially the calculator before there was the character of the calculator.
Ah.
He collects information on heroes and villains and sells it to people. And so he was using the cat to spy on the JLE. So it does appear, I don't know for sure, but it does appear that this may be the end of that storyline.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yep, yep. So then we get into the Catherine Colbert segment, drawn by pencils, at least by Russell Braun. I like that she offered to be the first one to go as the team leader. I like that. And then when you get into it, I mean, first of all, Russell Braun did a good job trying to mimic Bart Sears' art style. I mean, Catherine has all the right curves and has all the right poses that Bart does. The facial expression, I mean, on page 8, I mean, that if I didn't know better, I would think that was a Bart Sears face where Catherine's kind of smirking.
Mm-hmm.
It still looks like her. I mean, they've given her some crow's feet for being 10 years, but still definitely looks like her.
I like the fact they, you know, like you said, they actually gave her a look to make her look older.
Mm-hmm.
Not, this probably is the only time this happens in this entire book, other than, you know, the like hairlines and stuff. But
yeah, I think you're right. I think Russell Braun's the only one, because you can even see it in like Dimitri's face. He looks older in this mm-hmm. segment, and Silver Sorceress does as well.
Yes.
But you don't see it in the other segments, the artist drew. Yeah. Again, that sort of fits with the 10 months later than 10 years. What do you got?
I'm just now seeing on page 9, you can barely see it, but Ralph's hairline has gone so far back.
I didn't see that. Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Dimitri's bald, by the way. But yeah, that is funny. I did not notice that. Well, cheers to Russell Braun for taking the effort to do that. That's good.
To be fair, Metamorpho's bald, too.
That is true. Now, I have one criticism of the art here is Catherine leaves and she turns around and the embassy disappears. I did not understand that she was turning around. I thought a bomb went off in front of her. I did not understand that that was the embassy disappearing until I finished the comic and came back and read it again. So I realize now clearly she is turning around, but I didn't pick up on that. I thought something just happened in front of her and I didn't understand the correlation to it.
Yeah, that's fair, because everything right before that is zooming in on her face.
Yeah. But fun segment. I think Russell Braun did a nice job. So then we move on to Rocket Red, the focus of Fire's interest. pencils by Marshall Rogers. Now, Marshall Rogers drew some Justice League Europe issues, so it makes sense to have him back, which is nice. And I got to say, I think this is the most fun and whimsical future. I really, like, again, I had a lot of complaints of the overarching nature of this issue, but when you look at it segment by segment, this is a really fun segment. I love this one.
Overall, yeah, until you get to the last two panels of it.
It's super dark. Super dark.
I was like, this is the darkest indie. Yeah, this is the darkest timeline, Shag.
Right. So what happens is Merlin sends Etrigan to murder Rocket Red. And, like, Etrigan goes in the room and Rocket Red starts to say hokey smokes, which is like his tagline. He gets out hokey smoke, and then there's just a fire as Etrigan has clearly, you know, immolated him and killed him, which is terrible.
Yeah. And so endeth the legend of Dimitri the Brief.
That is so mean. It's so dark. But I have to say, this art is stunning. This is probably my favorite artwork of Marshall Rogers on any of the Justice League Europe issues he did. It looks really, I mean, he has got a knack for fantasy. And the inking, which I think, again, I don't have confirmation, but I'm pretty sure the inking is by Randy Elliott, is just, it works. It's really beautiful. The line work, the knights, the dragons, you know, Rocket Red, all of it is just, the layouts are stunning. And I got to mention the onomatopoeia. So, right. So, you know, Rocket Red appears on page 12, pops in, and then the knights crash into each other. But the onomatopoeia is all done in like that old English font. It's like crash, crash, clang, 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 clang. But it's all written in super fancy old English, which I thought was hysterical. Really great touch.
Going on with your angry theme, you know, Merlin just does not waver from completely bitter.
Right? Yeah, Merlin is out of F's to give. And he summons an Etrigan with the distinct purpose of getting rid of Rocket Red, who's King Arthur's new favorite. Yeah, it's brutal. But again, fun segment, other than the dark ending, a fun segment. Really like it. Then we get into Power Girl, penciled by Linda Medley, and she is back. Now you notice Rocket Red was in England, Power Girl's in England, so there is a little bit of a continuation. It stops being England in a little while, but it at least it's staying consistent for a bit. And Linda Medley, of course, drew a lot of issues of Justice League America, and she drew the General Glory issues of Justice League America, so it makes sense to have her on this segment. Works well. Glad to see her back. And as you mentioned in your recap, yeah, Ernie's a little horn dog, man.
It'd be different if he didn't have the wide eyes and big grin right there.
Oh, that is super crazy.
She's prettier than Grable.
Yeah, that's some super creepy. Yeah, he needs some therapy. So,
like you can tell, like this isn't the first time General Glory's had to just like reprimand him right there.
Right. It's like the time they met the JSA and he met Black Canary. He probably lost his mind. So, I will say, Linda Medley did, I think, drew Power Girl. Now that I look at it, she does look a little bit older here. Like, she doesn't have quite crow's feet, but she looks a little, her face looks a little more sullen. Mm-hmm. I think she went to the effort of making her a little bit older, which is good.
I really like that panel of her biting her lip, too. And it's just like, oh no.
That very cartoony. Really, yeah. A great use of Linda Medley's expressions. Another great expression I like is on the same page, you see General Glory with like his eye raised, and he's like, I'm afraid you'll have to come with me, miss. You know, and then a few pages forward on page 21, when Ernie has died, and we get three panels in a row of them looking at each other. Mm. The final panel, when she's like yelling at him, she's like, oh no, you don't! And she's got her mouth hanging wide open, yelling at him. I like that one quite a bit. I really enjoyed Linda Medley's cartoony style on Justice League America, and I really like it here too. I do think the plot point of Power Girl becoming the new Ernie is redunculous, especially with that haircut, but it works for the joke, I guess.
I mean, it's funny, but at the same time, this is reusing a joke from the JLA annual.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Metamorpho. So, Keith Giffen on art. This is a fun treat. You know, you don't get to see Keith draw very often. He did draw some Justice League America issues, so this is nice to have him doing it. A little hard to understand a couple of panels because of the period Keith was going through, but that's okay. That's okay. Still looks great.
It still really looks like the 5 years later, 5YL Legion.
Yes, it does. I just like on page 24, there's a panel where Rex is punching out one of the goons. I just can't figure out what I'm looking at other than Rex punching somebody. Like, I don't know what body part I'm looking at. It's this dude, the guy got punched. That's all I know.
the lower corner one where it's just clonk, womp, blah, blah, blah.
I can see Rex and I see his fist stretching, but I have no idea what part of the guy I'm looking at. Yeah. But whatever, who cares? It's fun. I love this period. I love the Legion 5YL stuff. So this was a real treat. And again, I said it already, bringing back the post-apocalyptic Hex in a period where he was just, everyone wanted to forget it. It's just hysterical. I love it. And Hex and Rex, that works really well.
Yeah, I love that. What's your name? Rex. Hex. No, come on, really?
It was fun. Up next is Silver Sorceress. So this is when I realized none of the characters had their own agency. Because I shouldn't say none. Metamorpho did. There, he beat up those guys. Elongated Man will in a minute. Crimson Fox will in a minute. But nobody else has. Catherine, Silver Sorceress, Blue Jay, Power Girl, Rocket Red. None of them have had any agency in this story. And this one, literally, she shows up and sits down while Anthro does everything. I mean, it's the perfect example of one of my problems with the issue. That said, the artwork by John Beatty and Michael Golden is very pretty. I love the giant splash page of the dinosaur. I thought that was really cleverly well done.
I like that it says honk.
Right? It does. It does. Like, how threatening is this thing really? You know? But I like that Anthro's in it and his girlfriend, which was, it was fun to see them. It was cute. Not two characters you expect to see very often. It's almost like someone went through a who's who and just started picking, like, who's obscure that we could use today?
See, there you go. You got more fodder for who's next.
There it is. Then we get Crimson Fox. So pencils and inks by Randy Elliott. So this is interesting. So he did all this himself. And this one, I feel, is genuinely fun. Like, I really like this one as far as the duo of Batlash, the womanizer, with Crimson Fox, the mannerizer, maybe? I don't know. Either way, those two together, the idea of them just getting into trouble is super fun. It's a great combination. So this one is, I like this one quite a bit. This one works well.
Okay, let me ask you something.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel like Batlash here is drawn in any way resembling James Garner in Maverick? Or is it just me?
Well, on page 33, mm-hmm. the bottom corner one where he's just got caught cheating, if you cover the hair, I could kind of see a James Garner face there, yeah. And now I don't know this for sure because I don't know enough about Batlash, but was he based on James Gardner's Maverick?
I do not know.
I would be surprised if he didn't. Ooh, page 36, he does look like James Gardner. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That top middle panel, mm-hmm. very much. Okay. That could very, you know, Randy Elliott may have been trying to channel that on purpose.
See, that I was kind of getting that from like the way he's doing the lines and stuff. It just seemed like old Maverick reruns to me.
Well, now I'm hearing the Rockford File theme in my head, but that's okay. That's always a good thing.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I know. Then we move on to Blue Jay, pencils by Kurt freaking Swan. Oh my gosh. And Kurt Swan with Randy Elliott inks is freaking gorgeous. It looks beautiful. It's a super fun throwback, especially given, like you said, the Legions and the 5YL era at this point, right? So that it's everything's dark, dark, darkity dark. But here it's the shiny, you know, 1960s Legion. Mm-hmm. It looks great. I love this.
Yeah, complete with cybernetic arm Lightning Lad.
Yes! And Polar Boy's there with the, you know, the Legion of Substitute Heroes. It's just really well done. I really, really enjoyed this one quite a bit, and mainly for the art. I mean, the story bit's cute, whatever, but the art is just beautiful. I like seeing Kurt Swan doing stuff in the 80s. I didn't know, until I did the Who's Who podcast, I didn't know how much I like Kurt Swan stuff, and so this was super fun.
Oh, yeah. When I first read this, I had no idea what Blue Jay's name was.
Okay.
You know, they only say it once, like earlier in the book, and they don't actually say it to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Power Girl just says, oh, it'd be like when Blue Jay was in charge again.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. And I'm just like, who is this dude? So for years, I just kept calling him Shrinking Violet with Wings.
Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Well, that's, you know, that's...
That's what they say.
Yeah, that's what Garth calls him.
Right. I like that. They mumble it, and then, you know, in unison, thank you for your interest in the Legion, and we wish you luck in placing your services elsewhere. It's like the total, you know, don't call us, we'll call you line. It's really cute. I liked it.
And to think about it, he gets a flight belt.
Right. I guess that's the consolation prize.
Yeah.
Right?
But I mean, think about it. He already flies.
Right. Exactly. The one person who doesn't need it.
Yeah. It's like when you give Superman a flight ring.
There you go. Exactly. Yep.
You know, unless he goes somewhere with a red sun.
That's fair. Now we're going to jump forward to the Elongated Man sequence, penciled by Ty Templeton, which, by the way, starts with a whole page of newspaper from the London News. And it's got a drawing, which is clearly by Ty Templeton, of Elongated Man just crashing on top of someone where he accidentally captured Moriarty. I love that Moriarty's a real person and Sherlock Holmes is too in this world. And Ralph just fits right in. Like, I genuinely could read a whole series about Ralph Dibny in the 1890s. Like, I would be running around London solving crimes. I would be perfectly fine reading that comic, especially drawn by Ty Templeton. I could do that all day long.
Well, remember, you know, he's a world traveler. He and Sue, like, hobnob with celebrities all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he has no problem hanging out with Tennyson and H.G. Wells and all these things, which is hysterical. I love it.
I do want to point out, H.G. Wells is a character in DC Comics continuity before he becomes like a main character, plot point, whatever, in the Lois and Clark TV series.
Oh, you mean the Flash TV series?
Well, that too, but in Lois and Clark, there's an H.G. Wells character.
Oh, Lois and Clark. I thought you were talking about the new show. I'm sorry.
No.
Yes, yes. Okay, I know what you're talking about.
Michael Bailey era.
Yes, yes. I took a minute to catch up. I'm good.
Time travel can do that to you, Jake.
Yes. The Sherlock Holmes bit, when Sherlock gets pissed off, I noticed something right before we recorded. When Sherlock Holmes storms off.
The needle! Two of them!
He's talking about drugs!
Yes.
Yeah! Sherlock Holmes
never
is going to go...
I caught that when I was younger. I was just like, what are you talking about, Sherlock? Oh, okay, whatever.
Sherlock Holmes is going to go shoot up. He's so pissed off at Ralph. That's crazy! And I love, you know, the idea of Ralph getting involved with the time machine, all of it. I mean, it's perfect. The Ralph segment is exactly where he belongs, and I love it. So the segment with the cat, again, I didn't know who the artist was. I went to the Facebook Justice League International group. Several people chimed in saying it was Marshall Rogers. Some people confirmed it on Twitter as well, so I will take them at their word. So these segments appear to be by Marshall Rogers, and they're cute. Again, they probably didn't make as much sense to you because you didn't know the history of the cat. But right. You know, several issues ago, this cat was shot, tranquilized by these guys when they were much younger and kidnapped, and now this is the cat's chance for revenge, which is why it's kind of funny. I love the scratchy, scratchy, scratchy art style. You know, it always reminds me when they draw the cat this way of Bill the Cat. You know, it's not that it looks like Burke Breathitt's actual art. It's just evocative of the Bill the Cat kind of sense. Because that's kind of what he's supposed to be like. If you look at him, he's yellow, not orange. He's got one eye squinting. You know, he's supposed to be Bill the Cat, essentially. He even says "ack" at different times.
Did you notice that Mr. Bigger's goons are aged, though?
Yes, yes,
you know,
I did.
Bald spot. One has a bald spot in the back.
Yep, yep. So that was done appropriately. Yeah. So and this is the big linchpin. So this is a big thing I want to talk about. So they come back to the present and Wave Rider. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Continuity error.
What you got?
Catherine on page 51 is wearing a jacket and her yellow shirt when the embassy disappears. During Catherine's actual segment, she's wearing a coat, orangish vest, purple shirt. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Shenanigans!
Well, you know what? With all the time travel shenanigans happening and history being changed, that's all that happens. She put on a different outfit that day. She is a fashion template in Paris. Everyone watches to see what she wears and then goes and buys it. So that must be what this was about. Because the very next page, and tell me if I'm right here, Wave Rider changes history right here, right now, so that this annual never happens.
Exactly.
Yeah, you talked about how he alters the future. Here he does it on purpose. He shames basically Mr. Bigger into shutting down the cat's observations, which means that 10 years from now, Mr. Bigger's pupil will never come in to steal Mitch's time machine. So that this annual never happens. And Wave Rider even acknowledges that. He says, never mind. Let us simply say I have closed off an unproductive loop of history. So this never happened. Interesting.
Like very many time travel episodes of a show. Oh. Yeah, well, we fixed it, so it never happened.
Right. In fact, I like here, there's a line where he talks about, he actually says the word, it's talking about time travel and anomalies, and says the word legends. So obviously, you know, it's not a reference to Legends of Tomorrow, but it's a nice nod for those of us who know that Legends of Tomorrow is secretly a JLI show to go, oh, you know, here's, okay, time travel, legends, that's nice. That's a little, nice little nod, that no one, accidental nod, if you will. And then my last comment is on the final page. Captain Atom, when he touches him and it says contact, that face of Captain Atom's, illustrated by Steve Carr there, the use of shadows are fantastic, that it makes it look dark and creepy. And it almost looks like Captain Atom is smirking, you know, or a dangerous smile. It looks perfect.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's something I didn't actually catch like the first few times because, again, you know, I read a lot of these out of order. I read the closing piece long before I read the JLE issue.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, in my head, oh, you know, well, you know, we see Captain Adam's future. Yeah. Okay. Hulk becomes Mark. The end.
Well, you know, even as a kid in 91, when I was shopping in the comic shop, I had heard that Captain Atom would be Monarch. I also put it together myself because, I mean, I read the Justice League Europe annual. I read the Captain Atom issues. I'm like, okay, this is clearly leading towards Captain Atom being, you know, Captain Atom series just got canceled. Of course, Captain Atom's going to be Monarch. And I was okay with that. And the very fact that it got out there, I said this earlier in the JLA segment, I don't get why they changed their mind. I mean, so what if word got out there, if a couple of nerds in the comic shops figured it out, you know, good for them, you know, let them feel vindicated. It just seems weird that they went to all these hoops to change at the last minute when they should have just followed through. But it is what it is, I guess.
I mean, it could have led to a lot more interesting stories. I say that Monarch could have actually been a bigger presence in the DCU for another 2 or 3 years. And then, like I said, you know, ship Captain Atom back to superhero rehab. And next thing you know, he's back leading teams with full of people like Booster and Beetle and Ronnie and the Not Wonder Twins. And
right. Well, what they could have also done was have it revealed that he becomes Monarch 10 years in the future and have the young Captain Atom from 1991 battling Monarch of the future, you know, battling his older self. That would have been a very logical extension to have the young Captain Atom battling his future self, which would have been perfect. But either way, it is what it is.
So I know you and Chris Franklin talk a lot, network stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris is big on the Justice League toys.
Yeah.
And people will always argue that, you know, there was a Firestorm figure. No, it was a Wave Rider figure. But he looks okay. But he looks kind of like Firestorm.
He does.
There is, where was it?
Oh, there's a line where Mr. Bigger's people say that they think that they're asking, who's this guy? And he goes, well, it looks like Firestorm, sir.
Right. Yeah. And at one point, Power Girl calls him Matchhead.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Look at you, Firestorm friend. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, Power Girl doesn't say it, Wally does.
Okay.
On page 32, you know, listen to me, Mr. Matchhead.
I should have picked up on that, but I've been dealing with the Wave Rider Firestorm controversy for a long time. Yeah, we used to speculate on Justice League, the cartoon, when Wave Rider would show up just in the background without a speaking part. It's like, that's supposed to be Firestorm? I don't know. He's not saying anything. Who is that, you know? Obviously, we all know it's Wave Rider now, but all right, then the only thing left to do is to argue about who is going to get the
One Punch Award.
This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it be fantastic, shocking, dramatic, funny, awe-inspiring, whatever. Both myself and Clinton will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted One Punch Award. Clinton, you're the guest, which is unfortunate for everyone listening, so please tell me your pick for the One Punch Award.
Okay, so long story short.
Too late.
Yeah, I come up with a version that's different every time I read it. There's always something that stands out to me.
Yep.
This time around, I cackled like crazy when Power Girl calls him Airwave instead of Wave Rider.
Oh, that was funny. Yeah, she's talked to Airwave. Yeah, that's funny.
But I'm not gonna nominate that one.
Okay.
I'm gonna be sensible. I'm gonna go with the entire Blue Jay and the Legion of Substitute Heroes sequence.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the fact that the actual Legion is so unimpressed with Blue Jay, and then Blue Jay is just unimpressed with the Legion of Subs.
Okay, all right. And you throw in some, you know, Kurt Swan artwork. That's a pretty good pick. That's a pretty good pick. Okay, so my pick, I had two different options. I've been bouncing between over and over.
Oh, look at you. Yeah, look at you. You know, you're complaining at me for my pick. And you're like, I got two.
Well, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, complaining about you. So,
Mr. Oh, it's my show. I can do what I want.
Well, I've made a decision between the two. If you'll shut up, I'll talk about it. So one of my picks was going to be just the cover because I love it so much. It's such a great idea to throw all these characters together and Kevin Maguire drawing it. You know, it's a great cover. But instead, I was going to pick the Rocket Reg segment because I felt like that was the most whimsical and the most fun. And I like the art so much. I really love the Rocket Red segment. So ultimately, it's going to come down to which is the more, you know, it doesn't have to be funny. It could be awe-inspiring. It could be whatever. Is it the Rocket Red segment with the amazing artwork and the gorgeousness and the shocking ending and you know, the hokey smokes and King Arthur's court? Or is it, yeah, like the Legion stuff? So what do you say, buddy?
Oh, shag, 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 shag. You know, I really want to win this one.
And but, I could argue the Blue Jay one, too, if I needed to.
But since the Rocket Red story goes the full gamut of emotions from exciting, humorous, heart-wrenching, plus you've got all manner of characters from the DC universe in there, I think I'll say that Rocket Red edges out just a little ahead this time.
Awesome. Well, I am thrilled that you did that. What you should have argued was Kurt Swan was back drawing the Legion. That would have been an easy win, but you already abdicated, sir. So congratulations to Dimitri. You are the winner of the One Punch Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment. Now, Clinton, I need to ask a favor, if you don't mind. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit, just in case Captain Atom turns out to be, oh, I don't know, Monarch or something? I mean, I feel pretty confident that's not going to happen. In fact, there's some proven cases demonstrating that's not going to happen. But would you mind hanging out just in case?
Yeah, I can. I think I can.
I appreciate it. Now, don't worry, Clinton. We will bring you back at the end of the show. And folks, while Clinton's taking care of that for us, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called
Justice Law.
All right, folks, and remember, get out on the social media, tag us at JLI Podcast. As I always say, it's about building a community of online JLI fans around the show. And remember, when you're posting your comments, if you live outside the United States, let me know, and we will assign you the appropriate embassy. So this time out, we're just pulling comments from our website, email, social media, just pulling bits and pieces specifically related to the most recent episode, which covered Justice League America number 52 with my guest Joe Tonello and Justice League Europe number 28 with my guest Mike Dynas. So first up is Dr. Chris Lewis from our England embassy. He says specifically related to Justice League America 52, he goes, "This was my first issue of JLA I ever bought, and only the second comic series I started picking up. With the exception of Guy Gardner and possibly Batman, I'd never seen any of these characters before this comic. Every issue is someone's first, right? Well, the incredible characterization and storytelling in this single issue did so much to inform my subsequent comic reading for the next 20 years. I bought Green Lantern and Justice League through thick and thin. I went on to pick up Martian Manhunter, everything with Booster Gold and Blue Beetle, Flash, and on and on. Perhaps it's the rosy vision of nostalgia talking here, but to me, this isn't an odd or awkward issue. This is Giffen and DeMatteis at the height of their creative powers. The increasingly serious drama of the main plot as Guy loses his rage with Ted, and the fallout of his anger against the team, and with the counterpart of the humor of Kilowog filling out his alien registration forms. Well, I got to say, Dr. Lewis, I'm so thrilled that somebody enjoyed this issue. Because, I mean, I want everybody to like every issue. So the fact that somebody loves this one makes me so happy. He says, specific to the art, I rather like the depiction of the heroes in this book. The word I would use is beefy. There's a tendency to make superheroes look impossibly cut. But here, Guy and Ted have a chunkier but still muscular build. More like a rugby player than a swimmer or a track athlete. I quite like that, and there can be differences in the team. And Batman looks great in this issue, in particular while he's swinging into the embassy. Now, regarding Ted Kord and the weight issue, he says, I agree that this issue doesn't feel like fat shaming. In more modern times, it would be a powerful story about some people's battle with mental health issues and the use of food as a relief. It could also be used as a springboard to talk about male anxiety and their appearance. Perhaps not so much an issue in 1991 as it is in the internet social media age. And as a man of what might kindly be described as a middle-aged physique, I think I could feel rather inferior if I was hanging out with superheroes the whole time. Yeah, you make a great point, Chris. Male anxiety is a real issue. Yeah. Then regarding Justice League Europe, he says, is Starro the only DC villain that has to be vanquished by using real-world vulnerabilities, as documented in, quote, those amazing marine organisms? If memory serves, it's Snapper Carr who identifies the Quicklime as a potential weapon in the original Starro story, something Beetle quickly dismisses here. And here, the team utilizes extreme cold. Apparently, with Starro, there's no mysterious starfish totem and no power-sapping kryptonite equivalent. It's Starro's just pure starfish through and through. Yeah, he does seem to be one of the more straightforward villains to beat, doesn't he? Yeah. Interesting. Good points, Chris. Thanks so much. Then from Joe Tonello from the Get Big podcast. Of course, Joe was our guest last episode. He says, thank you so much for having me on. It was an absolute blast and well worth the wait. Oh, well, thank you, Joe. It was great having you on the show. I really appreciate it. Then we heard from Rob McCarthy from the Hell on Wheels webcomic. Rob says, see, if I'd been reading at this point, I would have hated it. The jerk on the team should be handled more carefully than this. Hawkeye and Wolverine are both jerks who fight with their teammates, but they never hurt them. He says, Guy's a pain in the ass, and there are 3,598 people who do it better than he does. thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate that. I'm guessing the 3598 is the 3,600 Green Lanterns minus Nort, is what I'm guessing Rob's adding up to there. They're from Gus Casals from our Argentina embassy. He does the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. Gus says, great episode once again. I'm glad you pointed out the weaker points of the JLA issue. You were so pumped before starting, I was afraid it was just my take on it that was not stellar. But you agreed on most of my misgivings. The art, the bottle episode feel, all over the place plotting. He says, regarding Ted's weight and the jokes in the storyline, Chris Lewis mentions male anxiety, and I have to add, non-superhero body anxiety. These people have to be Olympic-level athlete shape for their whole careers, with Batman being the benchmark. That has to be a lot, and not something that someone with powers or a magic ring have to worry about. Yeah, I can't even imagine the pressure to be absolutely, you know, zero body fat, incredible physique and all that, that it must be in the superhero world. Ugh, unbelievable. I mean, just look at what the actors go through who play these characters for movies. And then Gus goes on to say, I love this arc of Justice League Europe. I think this is a pretty unique Starro story in that it's kind of small scale, no giant starfish, personal decisions and not punches involved, and brains over brawn. And Bart Sears goes out on a really high note. Yeah, Gus, you make some great points there. And yeah, what an awesome story for Bart Sears to finish up on. Then we heard from Bucky749, a.k.a. the American Samurai. He's got his own YouTube channel. He says, another great episode with a great pair of guests. You may recall last episode in the In-Stock Trades pick, I picked a Daredevil book. Well, Bucky asks me if I've read Daredevil Noir. I have not read Daredevil Noir. I might need to check that out. And then he says, also, you might want to check out the made-for-TV movie The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, as Daredevil is a guest star. Well, Bucky, not only have I seen Trial of the Incredible Hulk, I actually recorded it off the air, the network, onto my VCR when it aired, and I still have that original recording, and I still have a VCR, and I can still play it, as shocking as that is. I dug it out not too long ago. So yeah, I'm a big fan of The Trial of the Incredible Hulk and that version of well, I don't know if I want to say a big fan, but I enjoy that version of it for what it is. Thanks so much, Bucky. They're from Symbol Pending from the England Embassy, runs the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. They start off with a JLA issue. They say, Guy, to me, hits all the notes of being a victim of toxic masculinity, whilst Ted and Booster are potentially a more balanced take on masculinity. Obviously, it wasn't what they were saying back in the day, but I think it's interesting to look at these two through more modern times. Yeah, and that toxic masculinity issue came up this very episode about Guy Gardner. Interesting. Then on to Justice League Europe, Symbol Pending says, apparently the last few pages are set a few days after the rest of the comic. I remember this as within a few panels, two characters mention how calm Kara has been. Though if the Starro invasion was just a few days before Justice League America number 52, it kind of makes sense why the government is a little tetchy on aliens living on Earth. Though no government has ever been moved that fast on something. Yeah, you make a good point. And actually that time jump at the end of Justice League Europe is going to come up again in another comment. Then we heard from Ted Kilvington of Justice Trek. Ted says the blah-ha-ha era of Justice League started out as mostly serious and gradually got more comedic over the next 3 years, with the kahooey-kahooey-kahooey issues being the most blah-ha-ha of all. Then Justice League gradually became more serious, with breakdowns being as much more dramatic than comedy. By the time the next era of Justice League arrived, it was actually lighter in tone than the closing issues of the blah-ha-ha era. Wow, Ted, that's some interesting thought. I had not considered it that way, and as we dig deeper into breakdowns, I will be interested to watch for that. Then we heard from Martin Gray from our Scotland Embassy in the Two Dangers for a Girl blog. Martin says, I liked both these issues, with the JLA number 52 being especially good. Guide losing it with Ted was so powerful and so sad. While some of the Trevor Von Eden faces were indeed weird, overall I liked the art. Choices such as Ted shot from behind as he squatted were clever. The only character who totally looked off was indeed General Glory, who seemed to be based on Little Abner. No way would a World War II throwback have that shaggy mop of hair. He'd have a short back and sides. As for the Justice League Europe issues, that was a nice wrap-up to a fun story. You really can't go wrong with Starro. And yes, the work of Bart Sears put into the cover was astonishing. Yeah, it really was. He deserves so much credit for that. It was amazing. Then we heard from Robert J. Smith, author of Petectives. Robert says, I wonder if Guy's rage was fueled by Beetle's prank 7 issues ago. Guy didn't mention it, but it wasn't that long ago, and it was yet another humiliation at the hands of Ted Kord. Yeah, you know, Robert, that is a really interesting point. I mean, the prank Ted pulled at the skating ice rink, ice capades thing was pretty horrible. So I don't know if this level of revenge was merited, but yeah, that, I mean, the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, it all adds up and it all weighed on Guy. Maybe that's a sign of that. Interesting thought. It doesn't excuse what Guy did, but maybe you can see the pieces compounding on him. Then we heard from Noah Tarnow of the Big Quiz Thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast. Noah says, this was the first JLA issue I had bought in years. I guess that boxing cover worked on me and it hooked me enough that I stuck with it and have nothing but positive memories of breakdowns. Oh, see, that's awesome. Wonderful. I like to hear some people have positive memories of breakdown. That's great. He says, that JLE cover was so damn good. Starro is such a visibly striking character and I'm still annoyed it wasn't the villain in the Justice League movie. Well, at least we got him in Suicide Squad, but still. Then we heard from Doug Adamson from our Scottish embassy. Doug says, another great episode and nice to hear new voices as well. Kudos to Joe for holding out for this issue, and it was an interesting discussion, and his points about Guy's personality and head trauma being partly responsible for his actions does make sense. That being said, it did feel a bit out of character that Guy would cheat to beat Ted. Even when the red mist descends, he'd want to show Ted up and beat him fair and square. You know, Doug, I agree, and the more I've had time to think about this, I really do feel like Guy's actions are completely out of character. I mean, ultimately, the story obviously happened. I mean, the writers wrote it. It was published in JLA. But it really doesn't feel like Guy. It's almost, I don't want to say you want to ignore that it happened, but it doesn't feel like something Guy would do. Especially after we've been following him all these years, it doesn't seem true to his character. So I guess it is what it is, but it's something to think about. Then Doug goes on to say, as to Mike, I don't care what the exchange rate is between Canadian and US dollars. He brought real value to the episode. Oh, gosh. And proves to me once again that Canadians are very funny. Then he says, what I do have issue with is the critique of how Justice League Europe dealt with Starro in the end. So what he's referring to is both Mike and I kind of jumped on the case that it seemed like the resolution came way too fast and that Ice is the one that saved the day. So what Doug says is, personally, I thought it was genius and a perfect way to end the cliche superhero slugfest we might have expected. Overall, the scientific solution to Starro gave me a 1960s or maybe a Flashfacts-style vibe, where outthinking the villain was often the case. We don't need massive endings to every battle, do we? You make a good point, Doug. I mean, that's a great counter-argument, is that it was more of a scientific solution. It was sort of bypassing the big fight. So it was, I can see your point. Then we heard from DC Davis's Shag is right again. John Q said it in the last episode in the feedback, and Shag went and mentioned earlier in this episode that the way to get your letter printed was to grab the editor's attention. I figured, tell Shag he's a slam dunk. So, did it work? Did it? yes, it did, DC Dave. Yes, it did. Then he says, another great episode and great co-hosts. Then we heard from Herbert Fung, who says, another great episode. So Starro got put on ice, and then next to the ice cream. Fun. But isn't Starro from space, and can it travel through it unassisted? As yet another con stated, it's very cold in space. You make a great point, Herbert. Why did cold affect a starfish that can survive in the vacuum of space? Okay. Then he goes on to say, I miss the letter columns. And speaking of Canadians and letter columns, anyone remember T.M. Maple? Oh, yeah, I do, Herbert Fung. Wasn't it the Mad Maple? Isn't that what it stood for originally? Mike Dinas remembers him, too. Mike says, T.M. Maple, that name brings me back. Wasn't there a DC letters column where they outed who T.M. Maple really was? Well, Siskoid's got the answer. Of course, Siskoid from our Canadian embassy. He does shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, like Who's Editing and FW Team Up and many more. Siskoid says Jim Burke revealed his own name in Scott McCloud's Zot number 21 and around the same time in Action Comics Weekly number 615. Sadly, he died of a heart attack in 1994. Oof, wow. Way to bring the room down, Siskoid. Then we heard from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy adventure novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and now Time Problems. Jason writes regarding Justice League America number 52, I remember this one being off-putting back in the day. I think the art was a huge comedown after the awesome Adam Hughes, and I never liked it when Guy would get away with stuff like he does in this story. I like Guy as belligerent, cocky, a jerk, a blowhard, an egomaniac, but depicting him behaving in such a cruel or criminal ways like this really takes me out of the story and leaves me wondering why they keep him around. As to his assault on Ted is quickly forgotten, and they end up working together again for a long time, and it's not mentioned. Yeah, again, I fall back on my feeling. It just feels out of character. It just doesn't feel right. Maybe someone should punch a wall and make that unhappen. So if you could, Superboy Prime, get right on that. That's Shag, by the way, saying that, not Jason. All right, back to Jason's comments. He says, Justice League Europe number 28, for me, this Starro storyline is the last hurrah for this version of the JLE. Armageddon 2001, we'll see Captain Atom off the team book, and the book is subsumed into the Breakdowns crossover. And then there's that reboot with Hal Jordan and Aquaman on the team and Dimitri gone. Yeah, the League Europe specifically does really change after this. You make a good point, Jason. I'm hoping to see some semblance of them through Breakdowns, and I guess we'll find out as we go. All right, and now for... I've read a lot of opinions of people who enjoy these comics. Now for the other side. We're going to hear from my buddy Ward Hill Terry from Stop Calling Me Frank. Ward, you may recall, was on an episode a while back of Justice League Europe, and Ward had some strong words. I always say that I love Ward Hill Terry. I always enjoy my conversations with him. We love talking about superheroes and the same stuff, but we always end up on the opposite side of every issue. So he says, first, both guests were terrific. Thanks, Joe and Mike. Now for my whining. You can talk and talk, but you cannot convince me that Guy Gardner is or ever was a hero. He may be sympathetic at the end here, but so was the Mole Man. Still a villain, like Guy, only thinking of himself. Heedless destruction of property and callous disregard for anyone else. Over the course of these two books, the characters have been sort of on a parallel world. Characterizations and supporting characters developed in their own series are disregarded for the sake of the joke count. It's even worse in Justice League Europe. Issue after issue has seen the JLE treated by the creative team as the inferior five. The writers do not know who these characters are or what they can do. Power Girl has exhibited no powers in this book in months. Captain Atom, who can do almost anything a writer needs him to, has consistently been a terrible leader. Shag was pointing out the JLA has to come in and rescue them again to fight sea stars. These are regular Earth starfish, not aliens. Now, by the way, Ward Hill Terry actually listed the correct scientific name for starfish, which I can't pronounce, so good job on you, Ward. Anyway, he goes on to say, I don't mind a mix of humor and superheroics. I'm just frustrated that all these great characters are not being used to their potential. And at least there's some funny bits here. The issue I did with Shag wasn't funny and the heroes were useless. Thank you, Ward Hill Terry. I sincerely appreciate your feedback. I really do. I love seeing the other side of the discussion, and it's always fun chatting with you, buddy. All right, then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, so while this was a good issue, Beetle saying he's had bullies that act like Guy Gardner wasn't as effective. Beetle should always be ready for a fight, and he should have been prepared for that attack from Guy Gardner. But it is pretty pathetic on Guy's part to attack him in such a way. Granted, Guy does mention he was bullied as well, so maybe this is a defense mechanism on his part, though he needed to control it better for the situation. Guy realized he messed up, though, soon enough, and he may need to seek counseling for his emotional outbursts. That might be the problem. Well, thanks, Liz. Appreciate that. Then we heard from Subgum Doug. He says, I noticed that there's been no time in this Starro story for the Kilowog to bomb out and take in dinner and a cat show. Oh, yeah, and spend the night in jail with the Apostrophe Pals. For... Apostrophe. I just got that. Apostrophe Pals. Jean and Nort. That's great. Anyway, he goes on to say, for sure, this month's boxing issue cannot be shoehorned in between the panels of the Starro fight either. Again, because Kilowog. So I was glad to see that a little time jump was included between pages 19 and 20 of the Justice League Europe this month to allow for these JLA stories to take place. Captain Atom references not a temper tantrum for days. handily allowing for stuff to happen in the interim. I appreciate you pointing that out, Subgum Doug. I had not even thought about the fact that these two issues didn't necessarily work on a time scale together. Interesting. All right, then we're from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl to Huntress podcast. Tim says, regarding Justice League America number 52, as someone who gained a pizza belly in college and struggles to minimize it to this day, I really identified with Ted's look and plight, and I love that his paunch doesn't stop Ted from being able to fight. He's still awesome. And I have to give props to Chris Lewis as the first commenter who mentioned both Ted and the Watchmen TV show, which made me realize that Night Owl was also depicted as pudgy in the original Watchmen series. Are they turning Ted into Dan? If so, that'd be an insane meta loop back. You make a great point there, Tim, about the reflection of the weight issue with both Dan in Watchmen and Ted here in JLA. And really, it wouldn't be the first time this has happened with the Watchmen characters. I have always said that even though the question inspired Rorschach, I think Rorschach then re-inspired the question we got afterwards. That's always been my belief. So I've always called that like a snake eating its own tail. So yeah, I could see that with Ted and Dan also. Interesting. All right, then Tim goes on to say, and yes, Wanda in this issue has to be the same woman from Max's solo story in issue number 41, just with a different hair color. Another callback to number 41 is the name of Max's driver, Rodolfo. But actually, Max used his power so the driver would let him call him Rodolfo. In this issue, Max jokes about that with Wanda. Max, have you really learned anything about boundaries? Then Justice League Europe number 28, Tim says, lots of running and fighting because Captain Atom doesn't know what to do. It's funny, I can explain why I accept this, but I don't expect anyone to really agree. In Cap's own comic, he didn't really get a lot of experience fighting supervillains. He did just as many stage fights as the purely military operations, so I can see he's still learning about the metahuman world. Also, he's had only like 4 publication years of experience, unlike the decades of Jean or Batman. Finally, from the very beginning of JLE, Cap admits he struggles with dealing with civilians. He's socially awkward. He doesn't know how to relate. He says the wrong thing. He's kind of lost in his own world. Wait, is Captain Atom an army nerd? Well, Captain Entropy has a thing or two to say about that. He follows up immediately and says, not army nerd, Air Force nerd, Tim. And he says, Captain Atom is a fighter pilot and a company grade, which is relatively junior, commissioned officer. Pilots spend most of the first several years of their career learning to fly the aircraft well, and in the case of combat aircraft, employ it as a weapon system. There's probably less opportunity for leadership experience in the first few years as a single-seat fighter pilot than in any other commissioned officer career field in any service, according to the pilots I've known. So he's being taught about leadership and maybe practice it a little in his commissioning source, but if he were to continue in his flying career and follow a traditional path, almost all of his leadership time would still be ahead of him. His troubles in the role are not unrealistic. Wow, Captain Atom, dropping the knowledge bomb. That is awesome, man. And it makes so much sense, and it totally ties in Captain Atom's insecurity. Unfortunately, I doubt the writers were thinking of any of that at the time, but I love how your knowledge of the real-world situation was able to bring it and explain that sort of loophole in the story. So thank you so much, Captain Entropy. Then we heard from Mike Dinas from the Pacific Canadian Embassy, and of course was in our last episode. He says, regarding Justice League America, while this issue may not have been the strongest, it had some great gags. To me, Elrond hitting himself on the head to signify the start of the boxing round cracks me up every time. And he says, I'm looking forward to the start of Breakdowns and Armageddon 2001, said no one ever. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Then we heard from Brett Young from Imagine 8 Design. He says, great show, Shag, Joe, and Mike. General Glory on the roster always felt like G.I. Joe when they added Sergeant Slaughter to the team. He just didn't fit there beyond a gag. I was a bit disappointed by Trevor Von Eden's art, not only because he drew a supposedly out-of-shape beetle, totally jacked, except for a perfectly rounded belly, but the lack of furniture drawn meant I couldn't count the couch and chair doilies. I love the doily comments. Oh, keep them coming, please. Then he says, now the JLE issue was much more fun. I usually get tired of the, quote, heroes get mind-controlled and attack other heroes, end quote, trope, but when you do it with a starfish, I'm in! Just a lot of good old-fashioned punching and refrigerator art. I have 3 kids, so every time I open the fridge door for some milk, I have to do it slowly or the rush of wind causes a million dinosaur drawings and school projects to flap around the kitchen. I completely understand what you're talking about. He says, Breakdowns is about to start, which means we're close to the end. I guess when this is all over, Shag will finally have time to launch the Kickers Inc. podcast. So there's that to look forward to. Now, Brett, I don't know if that's comment about Kickers Inc. is just coming out of the blue, or if you actually follow me on social media and stuff and know that I just got recently the first 6 issues of Kickers Inc. and read them, and they're a lot more fun than I remember. I'm not going to do a podcast about them, but they are a lot more fun than I ever expected. And given that the Super Bowl is right around this time of year, that's kind of fitting how it all works together. So thank you so much. And if you really, really, really want to know what I'm going to be doing coming up, folks, you should be checking out the Once Upon a Geek podcast, which is a show where I talk about anything I want to do, and the JSA Presents podcast, where I am talking about the Justice Society of America, and as the JLI show winds down, my production of JSA Presents episodes is going to ramp up. Specifically top of mind for me right now, in about, I don't know, 18 months or so, I know it seems like a long time, but as this, again, the JLI winds down, I'm going to start covering the Mike Paraback issues of Justice Society of America from the 1990s, so really looking forward to that. Then David J. Cook from Australian Embassy, man, he got in just under the wire. Like, I compiled all the feedback. I literally sat down to record. I was about to hit record, and I refreshed the comments on the website, and his just came in. And he pulled an interesting one on me. So I am reading this as he has written. I am going to do my best. So again, David J. Cook from our Australian Embassy says, "Good day from the Australian Embassy. Austruth, is that consulate? Although I've followed the network for ages, another listener here been flat out like a lizard drinking the last few months and caught up with this episode. Great show, and the creator interviews are ace. They're bloody brilliant. Good on you, mate." Oh my God, David. Do you realize all the other people from the Australian Embassy are cringing right now, actually probably everyone around the world are cringing right now that you made me do that. So thank you so much. Glad you're catching up on the show. Over on Twitter, we've been hearing from Chris Pine. He is currently doing a listening read-through of our back catalog. And right as of this moment, I think he's on episode 11 or 12. He's been posting his thoughts on each episode on Twitter. It's been very interesting. And he's been sharing a lot of cool observations about the issues and our coverage. So we appreciate that. Thanks so much, Chris. You'll probably hear this episode in, I don't know, 2-3 years. Then over on Twitter, Changing Shades, he had a conversation with Derek Robertson himself and mentioned that we're going to be covering his issues of Justice League soon. So thank you so much for mentioning that to him. Really appreciate that. All right, folks, we are now on to the part of the show where I thank everybody who shared our show on their social media timeline, whether that be on Facebook or Twitter. And yes, I know, just like in the beginning of this episode, it's a long list of names. I get it. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these people because, I'll give you an example. Dr. Jennifer Swartz-Levine promoted the show on Twitter last episode. Well, this is the only time she's going to get mentioned on the show. So I would not want to cut this because, you know what? I want to recognize all these people. I want to thank them because I sincerely appreciate their efforts. It'd be criminal not to thank them. So, here we go. Here's everyone who helped promote the last episode by sharing on Facebook or retweeting on Twitter. Our thanks go out to Al Girding, AP3 Talks Geeky Stuff, Between the Pages Blog, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook Group, Canadian Geek, Changing Shades, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Christopher Luke, David Ace Gutierrez, Doug Adamson, Dr. Pulp Culture Bowling Green State University, Dr. Jennifer Swartz-Levine, Ed Moore, Frederico Hernandez, Geek to Me Radio, Gus Casals, Jake Muir, Joe Tonello, John Coos, John Wilson and his account John Reads Comics, Jose Sarti, or Ma Zinger 1978, and his Homework the Podcast account, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keechy Baker, Con L, Liz Ann Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matt Anderson, Matthew Cody, Max Romero, Max Traver, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mick Jameson, Mike Dinas, Mo Walker, Noise Guys Motion Picture Podcast, Norman Wins, Opal City Confidential, a Starman Podcast, Patrick's Tactics and Tutorials, Pragmatic Golem, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Rob Kelly and his accounts for Digest Cast, Treasury Comics, For All Mankind Super Friends Podcast, and Mountain Comics, Sean Ross and his Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast account, Sengoku 1111, Siskoid, Stop, Let's Team Up, Superman Radio Revisited, Symbol Pending, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price and his Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast account, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Willie Yarbrough, and Zek Cap Boots. Oof. All right, folks. My thank you to all of you for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, as we've seen this episode, from the thanks in the beginning of the episode to this right here. This community of JLI fans we've built together is absolutely amazing. You guys are the best. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Joe Tonello or Mike Dinas. Let me know know, and I'll be sure to include it in the next episode. And please keep those cards and letters coming. Best place is at our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave your comments in the show post there, and of course, they end up here in the feedback section. Over on Facebook, you can reach us at Justice League International, Blah Ha Ha Podcast, and on Twitter at JLI Podcast, and our email is jlipodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Joe Tonello and Mike Dynas for appearing in the most recent episode of the show, and thank you to you listeners for being such awesome human beings. I really appreciate it. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if we can bring our guests from this episode, John Wilson and Clint Robinson, together in the same episode. Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron. The
Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Power Seven Man. Soldiers of Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire and Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Can I get a tall chai?
And a large black coffee.
And I suppose you're here with no agenda, as per usual?
On the contrary, I'm here for comics.
I think I can help all of you. Hello, I'm the caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and I host a podcast called Coffee and Comics. On this podcast, I summarize, review, and discuss comic book issues, stories, and related media, usually in the span of time it takes to have a cup of coffee. Sometimes I'm joined by a guest, and sometimes I'm flying solo. So pour the coffee, take a sip, and turn up the volume as you listen to the Coffee and Comics Podcast. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, and directly on coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com. And remember, this is where the comics are never too old, and the coffee is never too cold.
All right, folks, we are back from break. We have cleared up the entire Armageddon 2001 crisis. It all makes perfect sense now, and it does appear the JLI teleporter has brought both together John and Clinton. Hooray! So, John, first off, thank you so much for appearing on the show. You've been very patient, waiting 7 years to be here, and I appreciate it, and it's always a blast to talk to you. And now that I think about it, this is the first time we've ever podcasted one-on-one together, I think.
You and I were on an episode, I think, with Sean. About Doctor Who.
Yeah, we did some Who True Freaks, but this is the first time you and I have ever done anything one-on-one.
Yes.
So this
it can't be the last. It can't be the last.
It won't be. It absolutely won't be. But if people want to hear more of you without me around, and not that you haven't been a shill this entire episode, would you please tell the listeners where they can find you on the internet?
JohnReadsComics.com is where you can find all the podcasts I have produced over the years. The current project that comes out almost every week is Superman in Crisis, where every Monday I talk about the Superman comics that came out on that date 37 years earlier. So 1986 right now is, of course, the end of Pre-Crisis Superman. That's the year that I'm covering. But you can find all the episodes I've done of that. Previous shows that I've done all are over there. Next year, if you like Babylon 5, there's going to be Babylon 5 30 years later with me and Blaine Dowler, but that's a whole year away.
Woohoo!
And yeah, so follow me on Twitter at John Reads Comics, and there is no H in Twitter or John.
Well, again, John, thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute blast. I appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks for having me on, Shag. This was great.
Now, Clinton, I am so happy to finally have you on the show. You and I, as I said, have been friends for a very long time, and it's glad to have you here, my friend. So if you would, please tell the people where they can find you on the internets.
Well, I'm glad you asked. People can find me still on the Twitters at CoffeeComicsBLG, where I post up things related to my podcast, Coffee and Comics. It's a show where I look at a comic roughly in the span of time it takes to have a nice little coffee break. But if that's not your fare, and I don't know why it would be if you're listening to a show about the JLI, you can also find me over on the Longbox Crusade Network, where I do a show called Fan Film Fridays, looking at online fan films.
Awesome. Well, again, Clinton, it's such a pleasure to have you here. And as our resident Armageddon 2001 expert, it was perfect symmetry to have you here. And I appreciate it, sir.
Well, I'm glad you finally got me here after, what was it, 16 years, 17 years?
Something like that, I guess. All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it. Come back next episode when we cover Justice League America number 53 and Justice League Europe number 29. Yes, it is the beginning of breakdowns. And we'll have two more guest hosts to help me cover the issues. Who will they be? Come on, folks. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm John.
And I'm Clinton.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast. Want to make something of it?